Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
I said, I don't watch college basketball. You don't watch college? It's about to be on and I said, yeah, but the report just came out. This was like 2 days right before this report came out, the 13th Amendment. They're going to use the 13th Amendment clause to make the players not get paid. I said, so I pretty much positioned. I can't remember exactly how I worded it, but I worded it in a very slick way to say I'm not watching slaves play basketball.
Every year, March Madness brings in big ratings and a ton of money for the NCAA, the TV networks, and the coaches. But what do the players get? Supposedly a free education. It's a perennial debate. Should we pay student athletes? But let's look at this debate through another lens. Those student athletes, particularly the ones on the best teams, many of them are black. But the coaches who train them, the schools they attend, the audience who watches, mostly white. It's a dynamic that raises all sorts of questions about big-time college sports, race, and fairness. NPR's Gene Demby and the Code Switch team tackled this in a recent podcast, and he's come on the program to talk about it. Welcome.
Hey, Lulu.
So, Gene, let's start by looking at the money involved in big-time college sports. Mm-hmm. You looked specifically at the Power Five.
Yep, the Power Five conferences, the SEC, the Big Ten, the Big 12, the Pac-12, and the ACC, they win all the trophies and they make all the money. According to ESPN, in 2015, they made $6 billion.
$6 billion?
Billion with a B. And they have their own cable channels. I mean, they're major sports players. And almost all that revenue comes from two sports, men's basketball and football.
So where does all that money go?
Not to the student athletes. Right. Under NCAA rules, they're amateurs. They cannot be compensated beyond their scholarships and the costs of attending college. But it goes to coaches' salaries. It goes to facilities. It goes to the conference commissioners, who all make more in excess of $2 million now. There are a lot of people who are millionaires because of these sports. And so everyone gets paid except for the student athletes.
So how does race factor into all of this?
I mean, race is all throughout this conversation and the way people think about it and who the actual players are, literally, in this case. So Sean Harper, who is a scholar on diversity and higher education at USC, said that, you know, many of the schools in the Power Five were either officially or effectively segregated for most of their histories. And that has really tangible consequences for the way campus life looks. And so these are conceived as white spaces. Their fan bases are white. Their alumni bases are white. Their cultural spaces are white. And so black students will be players in football and basketball. They'll be on the court and the field, but they won't be in the stands.
So you're saying black people will be players. What do those demographics look like?
So most of the players in the money sports in football and basketball at the Power Five schools are black. So 56% of the basketball players, men's basketball players, are black. 55% of the football players are black. But 2.4% of the students at these schools are black men. And so this is only 2.4%. I know that was shocking to us, too. But there's this weird paradox that happens, right? So you have black men on these campuses who are basically invisible in the classrooms. But at any given time, during any given academic year, the most high-profile undergraduate at one of these universities is likely to be a black basketball phenom or a black football star.
What did you find out about if these stars are actually getting the education that they've been promised.
So Sean Harper, the diversity expert from USC we were just talking about, crunched these numbers, and he found that at the Power Five schools, almost half of the black students in these two revenue-generating sports are not graduating from college. You would be better off actually being a black male student who was not on one of these teams. And that's important because the NCAA and supporters of not paying these athletes often talk about that student athletes are more likely to graduate from college. And that might be true for some students, but it's not true for black male athletes.
So why? What's keeping them from graduating?
We've talked to a bunch of people who talked about how hard being a student athlete is. People are dedicating 40 to 50 hours a week officially, you know, to being student athletes, to going to practice, to training. And then after they're done all those things, they have to go to class. They have to still be students. And, you know, they're often shuttered into classes that are maybe not the majors they want to be because those classes don't align with when their football and basketball schedules are. And so they're not graduating from college. And part of that is because the incentive structure is set up for the schools to value them as athletes before they value them as students.
So obviously there's divided opinions about whether or not student athletes should be paid. Do we know anything about how these opinions break down?
Most Americans do not want to pay student athletes, but there is a big racial split. 60% of white people are opposed to paying student athletes. That's according to the Washington Post and the ABC News poll from last fall, while a small majority, about 54% of African Americans, want them to be paid.
Have there been any studies looking at why certain groups are responding in certain ways?
So there was a study done last year by some researchers at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst that looked at whether racial resentment was informing how people answer this question. And they found that the strongest indicator for opposition to compensating student athletes among white people, the strongest indicator was racial resentment towards African Americans. And there's a way that these sports are racialized because the most high-profile college athletes in these sports are black players.
Gene Demby, the lead blogger of NPR's Code Switch. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Lulu.
It isn't the issue of gun control. What we need is white supremacy control.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Duarte Geraldino, guest hosting this week. Across the nation this weekend, young people marched for change. Here are some of their voices.
Hello, my name is Johnny Benthal. I'm a senior at North Star Academy. I'm currently volunteering at the March for Our Lives. We're getting up and ready. I'm here with my friend
Tiffany Hawkins.
And we're excited. It's cold outside, but it's okay because it is for a good cause.
A great cause.
We are really excited and ready to see who's going to come out and support.
Hi, my name is Gina Matos. I'm 18 years old, and I attend Eastside High School in Newark, New Jersey, and I'm on my way to March for Our Lives, Newark.
My name is Uma Mariam, and I'm 17 years old. I go to Martin Van Buren High School in New York City, and currently we're on our way to the March for Our Lives protest in Washington, D.C.
Hello, this is Ann Bully. I'm 17 years old, a student from Martin Van Buren High School. The time is now 7:11 a.m., right now, I'm on the bus with my leadership class. Right now, everyone on the bus seems excited.
The whole purpose of our going to the protest is really standing up with the generation, with our generation, sharing our voices so that they don't feel alone.
We are the future! We are the future!
I'm feeling really empowered right now. I'm really amazed at the turnout that has come. There's a lot of people here, and I'm just amazed by the amount of support that we have right now.
Not today, MRA! Not today, MRA!
Right now, I'm at the March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. As I expected, this place is packed. Right now, I'm standing in front of the March for Our Lives stage, and there is a student speaking right now. Listen.
I was crying hearing some people. Because if that were me, if that happened to any of my family members, or my brother, or me alone, or my friends, my best friends here, I wouldn't know what to do. But seeing them gather up courage and coming together gave me hope that my generation can really change history once and for all.
Look at the numbers here in the crowd today. Do you see this?
Enough is enough!
Enough is enough!
Enough is enough!
It's Gina Matos. I'm here at March for Our Lives, Newark. There's got to be
thousands of people here. There's parents, teachers, students. Like, it's amazing.
To see those students talk about their experience, and it just makes this march mean a lot more to me, hearing the speeches from these students, like, up close and personal. And you just, it's very heartbreaking, and seeing everyone looking at the people talking, and I can see the looks on everyone's faces, and you can tell that everyone here is just so passionate about this cause.
No more.
No more. Should we have to stand up to this kind of cruelty? No more should we have to be silent. Because if our silence is taken for granted, we shall no longer keep our mouth shut.
I think I'm very proud of what I did today, and I think like this will help me continue to move and do more outside of school and more like into City Hall. I want to do something for Black Lives Matter. I'm not sure what I want to do, how I want to do it, and when I want to do it, but I want to do it before I go to college, because I'm sure I won't be going. I won't be staying in state, so I want to make a difference here before I leave.
In my day-to-day life, I just hope that I'll think back on this time when I went to D.C. and I participated in an event that I really believed in. Maybe later down, gun laws might change. Hopefully they will, but even if it doesn't, like, I don't think anyone here will give up.
Very powerful moments captured on tape by young people who want to make a difference. Now, that was this weekend, but on Monday, what are those students feeling about the future? One of those students you heard from was Janae Benthal. She's a senior at North Star Academy High School. It's a charter school in Newark, New Jersey.
It was extremely empowering to see, like, all the different people that came out. Like, it was more than just, like, the people from Newark. It was also the governor there. So it just felt like it was very, like, liberating and powerful.
So why did you go, Janae? What were you trying to gain from this?
Well, I went because I led the walkout at my school first. And so when I found out about it, I was like, okay, this is more widespread. And this is something that I can do, like, more like, yeah, it's like more widespread, and it's something that I can do, like, outside, that's bigger, like, because it has something to do with City Hall. And so, like, I chose to, like, be involved with it.
What happens next for you? What do you do to keep this momentum going?
I think, well, right now it's more about raising awareness about gun control and to keep pushing about it. So, like, even though, like, I won't be doing, like, anything big like I did Saturday, I still want to, like, you know, be on social media and letting people know that these things do exist, or keeping them updated on things like the gun control votes that are happening in Congress soon.
So that's how you plan to stay involved, by keeping people aware of what's going on and to pressure lawmakers?
Yes.
So if you don't see change soon, are you worried that you might sort of give up? What are your friends saying?
I don't think it will cause me to give up, considering the fact that it's something that needs to be said. So, like, the more you're quiet about it, the less things happen. And so people around me have said, like, they wish that we can do things more widespread and things bigger than just the walkout, because the walkout didn't have anything to do with, like, government officials. So I think, like, taking it to, like, the government and City Hall is important.
So you were a leader. You led that first sort of walkout from your school. You went to this weekend's. But what do you say to some of the other people who may not be as bold or confident as you? How do you keep them in the movement?
you can keep them, like, in the, like, not in the background, but, like, the people who handle, like, the mechanical things of, like, on Saturday, we have people in the back who are just, like, in charge of, like, stage managers or making sure that no one was in the back, that they have to be in the back. So, like, small things like that can make them feel like they're making a difference, even though, like, they're not saying much.
When we look at Newark, you know, Newark has had sort of a high murder rate, even though it's dropping over the years. Newark is nationally known for its gun violence and actually saw an increase in non-fatal shootings in 2017. Does that affect the way you see these demonstrations?
I think it does, because I feel like a lot of people don't talk about gun control until it happens in places, in schools, in Florida, so like predominantly white spaces. So I think, like, it's something that is common here. So I feel like gun control is a constant conversation that we have here in Newark.
So you say that when it happens in predominantly white spaces, it's different than when it happens in places like Newark?
Yes. Like, there isn't much of discussion of gun control when black students are getting shot every day here, like outside of homes and things like that. But it becomes a topic of conversation when people in Florida get shot and killed. So I think, like, that's why a lot of people in Newark were against protesting, because it's like, well, what about us when we're in trouble, and what about us when things happen to us? So I think, like, it's important to make known the intersectionality between what happened in Florida and also what's happening in places of color like Newark.
What about wealth? Did you notice a difference once you were with a larger group?
I did realize the difference, because everything that we did, we had to do amongst each other. So, like, any food that we had for, like, the volunteers, people donated those. Water, people donated those. Like, everything that we had was pretty much donated. Like, we didn't get, like, you know, a lot of, like, government funding. But, like, everything we did was, like, very community-based. And so I think that was also good for us as well.
So I want to make sure that we're clear. What changes do you want to see in gun laws in the United States or locally in New Jersey?
Well, for me, I know, like, big things aren't going to happen fast, so it's just the little things, like getting rid of, like, ignorant comments like teachers should hold guns and things like that will, like, make me, like, hope to see a difference. Like, I just want to see a small difference in the way that government officials talk about the way gun control affects communities, and I hope that people of color communities such as Newark are going to be more included in the topic of conversation rather than just other wealthy superior groups. So I just want minority groups to be a part of the conversation.
And I heard you say on Saturday you are interested in getting involved in Black Lives Matter. How do you think the Black Lives Matter movement is linked to this movement, if at all?
Okay, because Black lives are always being killed off. Black lives are always being shot and killed by each other, by cops, by other people. So it's like, those two are at the intersectionals, because Black lives do matter. They're the same way we say that the way that people who are affected by gun control lives matter. So I feel like we're always being killed by our guns, and our lives are always being taken by guns. So this is how we can help stop these things. Like I said, these two things are at the intersection of one another.
Thank you so much, Shanae Benthal, senior at North Star Academy High School. Thank you.
No problem.
I was the first, one of the first. My first day with state trooper coming, putting me in the back seat of the car, and meeting the other black kids with six of us. And then seeing all of those parents and also KKK members having signs and throwing cans at us, spitting at us. We lived in the threat of death every day, every day. So I was just lost in this vacuum between integration and segregation and racism. That was my childhood. I was angry for years. Angry. Very angry.
A central figure in the momentous civil rights case Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka has died. Linda Brown was just a kid when her father tried to enroll her in a white elementary school. And a promise he made to her in 1951 led to a transformative U.S. Supreme Court decision 3 years later. Here's Frank Morris from member station KCUR.
In the early 1950s, Linda Brown was a kid growing up in a racially mixed Topeka neighborhood, just four blocks from Sumner Elementary School.
But
when school time came, I would have to take the school bus and go clear across town, and then the white children that I played with in the neighborhood, they would go to this other school. And my parents tried to explain this to me, but I was too young at that time to understand.
This is Brown speaking to NPR in 1973. Her mom, Leola Brown, told NPR that she and her husband, Oliver Brown, were faced with explaining racism and segregation to their perplexed little girl.
But her daddy told her that he was going to try to his best to do something about it and see that that was done away with.
After making this profound promise, Brown walked his daughter to the neighborhood school and tried to enroll her. The principal told him it couldn't be done.
He came back home and he was very disgusted. And together, he and the NAACP started a suit against the Board of Education.
It was 1951. Junior and senior high schools in Topeka were already integrated.
The final frontier in desegregating public schools was at the elementary school level.
Janae Nelson is with the NAACP's Legal Defense and Education Fund.
I think everyone knew that once we removed the barriers of segregation from public schools, from children, that would forever change the course of how Americans interacted with one another, how they viewed each other, how they perceived the humanity of each other.
3 years later, the case was before the U.S. Supreme Court, combined with four others from around the country, all lumped together under Brown's name.
Out of that, the name Brown, the surname Brown, became synonymous with notions of equality.
After the landmark ruling and the death of her father, Linda Brown moved back to Topeka, worked in early childhood education, traveled promoting civil rights, and played the piano in the church where her father had preached.
She was my sister in Christ.
Carolyn Wins Campbell knew Linda Brown nearly all her life, and not just as the face of desegregation.
She just wasn't that cute little girl. She was a woman that was caring, was spiritual, a loving person that'll be missed.
Linda Brown died Sunday after a prolonged illness. She was 75. For NPR News, I'm Frank Morris.
I know the one thing we did right,
hey!
Was the day we started to fight.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
Years ago today, an iconic photo of the civil rights movement was snapped on a street in Memphis. But the story behind that inspiring and unforgettable image has many shades of gray. Christopher Blank of WKNO in Memphis has the story.
Ernest Withers took more than a million pictures during his lifetime. His daughter, Rosalind, now runs a gallery of his work.
All of these drawers are filled with envelopes of negatives. This is all civil rights.
Withers became the de facto photographer of post-World War II African-American life in Memphis, from sporting events to social functions to the civil rights movement. His most famous image now hangs in museums around the world. It shows a wall of men, black sanitation workers, marching for better treatment.
And they're holding that sign that says, I am a man. And when you have to wear a sign that defines who you are, it just shows you how injustice has taken place for you to have to do that.
Withers had open access to civil rights leaders, and his pictures helped tell the story of the movement.
He always carried three cameras, and he would chuk.
One roll of film went to the white press, another to the black press, and the last he kept. But some of those pictures had an ulterior purpose.
Ernest provided a lot of information on what they were doing, what their plans were.
That's Mark Parascia, an investigative reporter and author of the new book, A Spy in Canaan. After Withers' death in 2007, Parascia discovered an FBI code name in some government files. Eventually, he learned that Withers had been a paid FBI informant.
They used Ernest's gravitas as a news photographer, and they would basically tell him, we want you to cover this march, under the pretext of a photographer. And they said, we want good identification pictures, face shots.
When Martin Luther King Jr. came to Memphis in 1968 to support the sanitation workers' strike, Withers contributed photos and tips to their pool of heavy surveillance. The government was worried that King's next march on Washington, the Poor People's Campaign, could get out of hand.
The FBI was very much determined to stop him.
King was stopped, but by an assassin, on April 4, 1968. But the FBI records around him and his associates remained. Some files haunted activists for years. This level of infiltration would later raise questions about Withers' legacy.
You can't throw it away and not say that it doesn't matter.
Dr. Ernestine Jenkins studies civil rights photography at the University of Memphis. She says that many in the movement now feel his double life was a betrayal. Rosalind Withers was as shocked as anyone to learn of her father's past, but says his work still tells an essential story.
Our history as African Americans, it gets lost. And I can truly tell you the era in which my father lived has been detailedly recorded.
Of all the pictures taken by Withers over more than 50 years, a group of striking sanitation workers remains his ultimate image, saturated with hope and despair, a symbol of every struggle where the goal is basic human dignity. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Blank.
Half a century of revolution. On the move, I greet you all in the city of Seattle on this fine, auspicious occasion. The 50th year celebration of the founding of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party is, as it must be, also a celebration of the very existence of the Black Panther Party itself. It is a celebration of grassroots resistance to state repression, a celebration of black resistance to racist oppression, and a celebration of a youth movement against the stifling conformity of the status quo of the 1950s and early 60s. 50 years ago, African nations were emerging from decades, some over a century, of European colonialism. Asia's Vietnam was fighting to free itself from American military occupation after besting the French at Dien Bien Phu. Black activists like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, called SNCC, dominated the news, and a young, dark man then named Stokely Carmichael broke through more than most. In September 1967, Carmichael brought black power to Seattle when he spoke at the University of Washington and shortly thereafter at Garfield High School before some 4,000 students. With his passionate delivery and calls for black revolution, Carmichael electrified his audience, as he did whenever he spoke. Elmer Dixon, then a member of the Black Student Union, reacted coolly to Carmichael's hot rhetoric, stating, "I didn't agree with anything he said. He used the word honky a lot. My best friend was white, and that didn't sit well with me." Elmer and his brother Aaron, who would later be named defense captain of the Seattle chapter, were sons of parents who were college professors. And thus, they came from middle-class backgrounds, as did several other activists who began in the civil rights movement and migrated to more militant movements like the Black Panther Party. The Seattle branch, organized in 1968, became the first chapter of the Black Panther Party to rise beyond the borders of California. In spring 1968, Chairman Bobby Seale and Minister of Education George Murray visited Seattle and met with the Dixon brothers and several other young Panther aspirants before granting Seattle full membership. I've always thought that there were never really just one party, but 44 different ones, depending on where it got organized. Seattle was not Harlem, Philadelphia, Baton Rouge, nor Boston. In a very real sense, every chapter was different, but Seattle, because of its local history, seemed more different than most. Seattle, before the Second World War, had some 4,000 African-American souls. But as the Great Migration reached into the 60s, its black population grew at the rate of over 400%, according to scholar historians Judson Jeffries and Jeffrey Zane. Many of the Black Panther Party chapters opened in cities with large black communities like Harlem, Chicago, Philadelphia, Baton Rouge, Baltimore, or Boston, for example. Seattle, with its relatively small black community of less than 10% had its own unique challenges as well as its own opportunities to build amidst a multicultural population base. Thus, their free breakfast program served not only black kids, but Italian and Asian kids who crowded into the party's Atlantic Street offices in a neighborhood known as Seattle's Little Italy for a hot meal before school began. Few party branches had such access to such broad communities. Like every other city, the party had its birth, its high points, and its passing into the mists of time. Today, 50 years after its founding, we now gather to remember its proud and glorious birth. We remember its bold, majestic place as a grassroots movement of young people who fought against ignoble state repression. We remember its place in American, black, and world history. In party, let me give the party slogan that echoed all across America and still has a certain kind of power 50 years later. All power to the people. I thank you for your time and your opportunity. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
In 1968, the national civil rights movement was in turmoil. Young black activists were feeling frustrated in Seattle and around the nation. As KUOW's Patricia Murphy reports, the scene was ripe for revolution when the Black Panthers came to town.
Good evening. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, 39 years old and a Nobel Peace Prize winner, was assassinated in Memphis tonight.
Brothers Elmer and Aaron Dixon were members of the Black Student Union when Martin Luther King was assassinated 50 years ago in April. Aaron Dixon told the UW History Project it was the moment where everything changed.
No longer did we feel that peaceful demonstrations was going to work, that we were now going to look towards other methods of demonstrating and getting our point across.
Just a short time later, Elmer Dixon says the brothers formed the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. At the end of April, there'll be a conference to mark the 50th anniversary. Dixon is back in the old Madrona neighborhood. In 68, he says members would train weekly in the playground right across from his mom's house and just blocks from a white neighborhood.
Any given Saturday, where you could come up and see 300-400 Panthers up there in military formation, drilling and training. And then we would march out of the park, down 34th, all the way down Cherry to Garfield Park, where we would hold a rally.
The Panthers cut an intimidating profile in black berets and leather jackets, but Dixon says they were also required by the party to be well-versed in the law. The Panthers' 10-point program addressed safety, social needs, and the oppression and incarceration of black people.
We weren't anti-white. We were anti-system. And a lot of people don't know that about the Black Panther Party. We had coalitions with every group. In fact, the phrase Rainbow Coalition was coined by Fred Hampton, not by Jesse Jackson.
Dixon says at the time, Seattle was perceived as a quiet Northwest town, but in reality, it was politically volatile. Congressional records show there were more than 70 firebombings between 1969 and 1970.
I won't say that there weren't probably some Panthers that were involved in that, because it was hard to control 300 to 400 Panthers.
Then on a summer's day, Dixon says, police raided the Panther headquarters on 34th, looking for a stolen typewriter.
I came around the corner and the whole street was full of police cars. I mean, like, there wasn't a spot that wasn't taken up. And that was the day they arrested my brother and my brother-in-law, Curtis Harris, out of the office here for allegedly stealing the typewriter.
The raid sparked riots. Civilians and police were injured by rocks and gunfire. Both men were acquitted. 50 years later, Dixon takes me by the old headquarters. His mom still lives around the corner, across from Madrona Playground. The building is split into two storefronts with doors side by side. In 68, it was Panthers on one side and a realtor on the other. Given the city's history of red line housing discrimination, Dixon says the realtor was pretty uncomfortable.
He spent very little time here. I think he was afraid to death of us, and probably was very happy when we finally decided to move out. I got to say hello to my brother in here. He's the keeper of the site.
Hey.
Hey.
Ben Abe has run his travel business in the old headquarters since 1982. The realtor is long gone, and now a specialty wine store is in that space.
We're working to get this designated as a historic landmark.
Hey, don't worry, man.
Abe has seen the neighborhood gentrify, but he's stayed, unlike many of the black families who lived here in the 60s.
Yeah, and I own the building now, great. And next door, too.
Oh, great. So great.
By fall of 68, the Panthers moved their offices into a house nearby, which would also become the first free medical clinic. We'll talk more about that in another story. These days, Elmer Dixon is working with the system, helping police departments and cities as a diversity consultant. The work brings him back to the playground he grew up on. There was a little bit of everybody out here, he says. White kids, black kids, brown kids. And as he looks across the old playground towards his mother's house, he sees it all as a full circle. I'm Patricia Murphy, KUOW News.
Okay, so what do you need? Besides a miracle.
Guns. Lots of guns.
Yesterday's march in Washington was just one more chapter in America's decades-long debate about guns, gun control, and the Second Amendment. But often underrepresented in that argument is a group of gun owners who believe they are a particular target of violence and need to defend themselves. NewsHour Weekend Special Correspondent Simon Ostrovsky has our report.
High ready. Fire.
This gun range is similar to others across America where firearms enthusiasts, proud and protective of their Second Amendment rights, can practice becoming a better shot.
There you go. Whenever you're ready. How you like it?
I like it a lot.
Move.
But this isn't a gathering of the National Rifle Association.
Usually the clubs that I see is mostly Caucasians.
Yeah.
And so I saw this club. It was pretty unique, and so I gave it a shot.
In August of 2017 is when I became a member of this chapter of the National African American Gun Association.
We're with the Denver branch of the National African American Gun Association. Chapters like it are opening up all across the country because for an increasing number of people of color, the Trump era has been a call to arms.
How ready? Fire.
You know, some of the things that we were seeing in the news, a lot of the things that the president was saying, and the reactions that we saw from a lot of members of the white community, not everyone, more white supremacists, it seemed like having some form of protection was a good thing for us to have.
The incident in Charlottesville, when you had the white supremacists, you had the neo-Nazis, and the white nationalists, and they came to that protest armed to the teeth. They had all types of weapons. And when a person got run over by one of their supporters, his answer was, well, there are good people on both sides. My theory is if you're marching under the Confederate flag or you're marching under the Nazi flag, which America fought two wars to get rid of, you're not a good person. Fire.
David Fannings is an Army veteran who believes the president's rhetoric has made the country less safe for minorities.
He's saying what they have thought and felt for a long time, and him being the leader of the country, it's like giving them a green light.
This is a 12-gauge shotgun. This one operates very much like an AR-type rifle. For home defense, a shotgun is real good.
To be able to be a member of an organization that was run by us, for us, that appealed to me.
With just under 25,000 members, this gun group is tiny compared to the NRA, which claims around 5 million. But in the last 14 months, the National African American Gun Association, also known as NAG, has grown from just 14 chapters to 52. Based in Atlanta, the group's leadership doesn't sound so different from its NRA counterpart.
The Second Amendment is an important right, just like any other right that we have, and it's one that our community has a complicated history with. But it's a right nonetheless that without that right, it's very hard to assume a position of a fully fledged citizen in these United States.
But at NAG, exercising your Second Amendment rights isn't just a way to defend yourself and your family. It's seen as an extension of something much larger, the civil rights struggle.
So some of the first gun control laws that came about in this country were related to race. They were related to keeping guns out of the hands of African-American people.
To contain the misery and violence of the ghetto, Oakland's all-white police department earned a reputation for head-knocking brutality that has left a well-remembered legacy of bitterness in the minds and hearts of many who lived in that time and place.
Back in the 1960s, some young African Americans in Oakland, California, responded to police overreach by following the police and observing arrests. They called themselves the Black Panthers, and they were armed to the teeth, legally. Their armed patrols and an open carry protest at the state capitol alarmed the authorities so much that in 1967, the state instituted an open carry ban.
Am I under arrest? Am I? Take your hands off me if I'm not under arrest.
Ironically, it was signed into law by then-Governor Ronald Reagan.
There is absolutely no reason why out on the street today a civilian should be carrying a loaded weapon.
But as president, he strongly supported the NRA and vocally defended the Second Amendment, as does the current president.
I am also proud to be the first sitting president to address the NRA Leadership Forum since our wonderful Ronald Reagan in 1983.
I'd be lying to you if I said the political arena has not affected our membership. People look at what's going on politically and they see some of the comments that are made by certain folks in high places, and it makes them a little unnerving. And that has definitely been a part of our growth.
While the new political climate is contributing to the interest in personal protection among African Americans,
Reason I put your brake lights are out.
Part of the reason NAG members aren't flocking to the NRA is a policing culture that predates Trump.
Sir, I have to tell you, I do have a firearm on me.
Don't reach for it, then. Don't pull it out.
The 2016 shooting of Philando Castile, a black gun owner with a concealed carry permit, outraged the African-American community. But in this instance, the nation's most established gun advocacy group didn't jump to publicly defend Castile's Second Amendment right.
Oh, as far as the NRA is concerned, I'm going to lay it out there because I don't sugarcoat it. I'm going to give it to you in the raw. You take it any way you want to. But you didn't defend my son the way you would have defended a white person. They should have stood up for my son and gave him the due respect that they do anyone else that's killed in that manner.
I used to be a member of the NRA, but I don't feel supported by the NRA towards my needs in my community. So it's just, they're not there.
Are you talking about incidents like Philando Castile?
Yes. He announced that he does have a concealed carry and he was lawful and he got shot immediately. The NRA did not come forward and condemn the deadly use of force on a person that was legally carrying.
Anytime there was an issue with someone who looked like me or who I felt could be a part of my family, I don't believe the NRA had their back or had their best interest.
Our oldest son is 27. He has a concealed weapon permit. He's allowed to carry. That worries me because if he's pulled over, he's going to be treated differently, and he's often targeted and pulled over. You know, it has happened to him more times than I like to admit.
The NRA did not agree to an interview with NewsHour Weekend. While African-American interest in personal protection appears to be rising, gun sales nationally are trending in the opposite direction. FBI figures show that background checks made by gun sellers dropped off during Trump's first year in office. The store in Aurora, Colorado, where the Denver chapter of NAG trains, is no exception.
For 8 years when President Obama was in office, you know, gun sales were incredibly brisk. So probably, you know, 15 to 18% drop overall in business since President Trump's been elected.
What do you attribute that to?
I think basically nobody's really too concerned about any new gun legislation. So people are taking a big sigh and, you know, they figure that they can buy whatever they want fairly easily, certainly up until maybe the midterm elections.
For now, members of NAG will keep sharpening their shooting skills and standing up for what they see as an essential civil right.
One of the things that's always affected me personally is that I've had people say, hey, you're a person of color, you shouldn't have guns, right? Because you can be a target. It's dangerous. My answer to that is I should have the right to have a gun like anybody else because I'm not a second-class American. I'm an American.
Is that a real gun?
Yes, this is a real gun.
Do you kill people?
No, if some guy's hurting someone, I try to shoot him in the leg or something just to stop him.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Is it true?
Is it true?
Is that true?
Is it true?
Is that true?
An unarmed black man who was killed by Sacramento police officers earlier this month was clearly shot from behind. That's the assessment today from an independent autopsy commissioned by the family of Stephon Clark. The police said that the 22-year-old was approaching two officers when they opened fire. His death has sparked protests that have been going on for the last week. His funeral was held yesterday. Ben Adler of Capital Public Radio has been covering the story and joins us now from Sacramento. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Ari.
Tell us more about what this independent autopsy found and how those findings compare with what the Sacramento Police Department had been saying.
Well, when the police department first released the body camera video of the shooting, it said in a statement, quote, "The involved officers saw the suspect facing them, advanced forward with his arms extended and holding an object in his hands." But the independent autopsy conducted on behalf of the family comes to a different conclusion. It found Clark was shot 8 times out of the 20 rounds fired by the officers, most of them in the back. Dr. Bennett Omalu, the forensic pathologist who conducted the investigation on behalf of the family, says it's reasonable to conclude that 7 of the bullets entered Clark's back and he spun after being hit by the first bullet.
The proposition that has been presented that he was assailing the officers, meaning he was facing the officers, is inconsistent with the prevailing forensic evidence as documented at autopsy.
The autopsy also found that Clark did not die immediately, but between 3 and 10 minutes after the shots. That's significant because the police officers did not seek to treat him until 5 minutes after they shot him.
Tell us more about the pathologist who conducted the autopsy, Dr. Omalu.
Yeah, he's the forensic pathologist, the first doctor to report on the traumatic brain injury known as CTE in football players. He was played by Will Smith in the movie Concussion. The NFL pushed back against him for a long time, only to admit later that the brain injuries are real.
At this point, can any conclusions be drawn about how police handled the incident? Ben Adler, are you there? We seem to have lost Ben Adler from Capital Public Radio. We will try to get him back a little later in the program.
One or more shots that might be in the backside of a...
Bear with us. We're just experiencing some technical difficulties. We have another segment coming up in just a moment here. We seem to have dropped the line with Sacramento.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Police shootings have been back in the news this week following the death of Stephon Clark earlier this month and new developments surrounding the 2016 killing of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge. In a moment, we'll speak with the mayor of Baton Rouge, but first, Sacramento, where the release of an independent autopsy by Stephon Clark's family has led to further protests and vigils. Hundreds of protesters gathered at City Hall last night demanding that officers who shot him be held accountable.
Black lives matter! Black
lives matter! Ezra Romero is a reporter at Capital Public Radio. He's been covering the story. Ezra, thanks so much for being with us.
No problem.
Help us understand the general feeling among many protesters last night.
Yeah, the community is angry and sad about the manner that Stephon Clark was killed. He was shot 8 times, and the majority of the bullets were in his back. This basically sparked fervor over his death. But they're not just upset about Clark. They want change. Some want the police to be demilitarized. Some want the same amenities and resources that are being invested in other parts of the city, like downtown. So they rallied, and there was quite a bit of anger down there. There wasn't really any violence that came out of it, but there was a lot of fervor. Jameer Sale, he's one of the protesters who made his way around downtown Sacramento, and he's from Sacramento. Here's what he had to say about the autopsy results.
The surprise comes from the fact that all these shots hit him in the back, you know, when the police said that he was lunging at them with a gun. You know, so the police are over here still defending this narrative where he's coming at them like he's a threat to them. At the end of the day, they murdered this man, and they need to take responsibility for it.
The protests, Ezra, were organized by the group Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter Sacramento. I wonder if you were able to speak with any of their members.
Yeah, Tanya Faison, she's the founder of the organization, and she actually led the rally last night. And when I spoke with her after the autopsy results were announced, she said it's disgusting and it's another blow to the community's lack of trust in police. She says this furthers the message that police should be responsible for shooting Clark when he had the unfair advantage. She says the police lied about every single thing and how many others have they lied about.
Mr. Clark's family organized this autopsy with an eminent doctor, and they, of course, have been outspoken. Did they make any statements last night?
Yeah, at one point, the demonstrators tried to take Interstate 5 again. That's the main artery that runs through downtown Sacramento. And when they did that, the officers wouldn't let them. But at that point, Stephen Clark's brother showed up, Stevante. And instead of encouraging the protests, Stevante asked them to stop. He yelled, "Let's invest in libraries and resource centers in the community and stop protesting." They didn't take I-5, and they just kept on marching.
Is there any other plans from here this weekend?
Yeah, there's actually a lot. There's a peace rally scheduled later today, and this evening another protest is scheduled in downtown. There's also at least two pro-police rallies or marches that I saw on Facebook scheduled for today as well. And as more and more unfolds, I'm sure there will be more and more protests and rallies and peace marches and peace moments here in Sacramento.
Ezra Romero of Capital Public Radio, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? Why genetic annihilation? All these people from Syria coming up in here.
Among the inmates of Saharanim prison, deep in Israel's southern Negev desert, are dozens of Eritrean and Sudanese men who have, in the narrowest sense, chosen to be there instead of deportation to a third country known to be either Uganda or Rwanda. Mukhtar Hassan says the inmates have made the right choice. He accepted a deal to leave Israel for Uganda in 2014, but instead found himself delivered to Sudan, the country he'd fled. Now he's made it to Uganda, where he's studying law, but says direct deportees from Israel have their documents taken at the airport, leaving them unprotected.
No one is willing to fight for this for these people's rights. But in Israel, there's at least activists and there's some local organizations.
Israel's government is trying to remove 40,000 Africans, mostly Sudanese and Eritrean, who entered from Egypt before a border fence was completed 4 years ago. The first phase of a detention or deportation policy targets single men. But for now, it's been frozen, pending a decision by Israel's Supreme Court on Monday.
The train was running very quickly. We at least stopped that.
Sigal Kokovivi is one of those behind the legal petition against the policy. She doubts the government has a defensible deal with Rwanda to show the court and hopes the freeze will continue.
But I think it's going to be very hard for the Supreme Court now to turn this around and say, without an agreement, without us seeing an agreement, this can go on.
Israel's prime minister, though, is determined to press ahead. Last week, he said unrestricted African migration would be more dangerous than terrorism. He's long argued that Israel has the right to expel people he calls illegal infiltrators.
Where somebody is granted asylum status, he can be expelled, but not to the country where he cannot be returned, in this case, to Eritrea. But if another country is willing to accept him, it's perfectly legal under international law.
It's an argument that holds little weight for Tesfazghi Azgodom, who fled forced service in the Eritrean army but had his asylum claim rejected in Israel. He says neither Rwanda nor Uganda offers the safe haven that should be his right under international law.
Let's say, what do you prefer, death or to stay in a prison? To stay in a prison. I prefer to stay in a prison instead of risk of death. I don't give up also. I don't lose hope. I don't give up hope.
In the short term, such hopes depend on the next decision made by Israel's Supreme Court, but more broadly, they rely on the outcome of what's been a vociferous national debate about whether African refugees now deserve the same kind of sanctuary in Israel as Jews fleeing Europe in the 20th century. A recent poll suggested two-thirds of Jewish Israelis supported the government line. Harry Fawcett, Al Jazeera, West Jerusalem.
We do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and eight others knew all of this history. But he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arson and shots fired at churches. Not random, but as a means of control. A way to terrorize.
This is KUT. City officials, activists, and community members gathered Thursday at the George Washington Carver Museum to discuss Austin's racial climate following the serial bombings earlier this month. KUT's Dalia Jones has this recap of the event.
Panelists discussed what the recent serial bombings that killed two people and seriously injured four others have revealed about Austin's current racial climate. This comes after outcry from the city's communities of color for what they call unfair coverage of the serial bomber and his victims. Austin Interim Police Chief Brian Menley says the city's racial climate has improved, but he says there's still work that needs to be done.
I think we're a city that has a history that we have to acknowledge of where we started from. And the steps we've made to do better, to continue to build the relationships and address those issues that are either real or perceived, because if they are perceived, they are real. And so we have to address that.
Activist Gilbert Rivera of the Rosewood Neighborhood Association agreed that steps need to be taken to improve racial disparities in the city. But he said it's worse than before.
What I see is a lot of the overt attacks on people of color from the past are now institutionalized. In the past, they used to move us with the barrel of a gun. Today, they move us with ordinances.
Interim Chief Manley also classified the Austin serial bomber as a domestic terrorist. This comes after Manley called the bomber a challenged young man during a press conference, which sparked outcry from some community members.
I've now had the opportunity to sit back and understand and absorb all of the impacts that it had on a personal level.
Chaz Moore is the founder of the Austin Justice Coalition, which advocates for marginalized communities. He said not originally calling the bomber a domestic terrorist minimized the chaos that he caused in the city.
Was the young man trouble? Absolutely. But he was a troubled young man that turned out to be a domestic terrorist. But because he was white, we gave him the benefit of being a human first, as opposed to a thing.
Moore also said the city needs to do more soul searching in order to improve Austin's race problem.
Our white brothers and sisters are going to have to learn how to be comfortable with being uncomfortable while talking about race.
Emlyn Lee of Brave Communities, which advocates for more civic integration, says residents also have to reach out to communities of color on a regular basis and not just on a matter of convenience.
It's hard because I know we're such a solutions-driven like society, and it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, clearly this is, you know, 400-plus years of just institutional racism. And so how do we build a community together is just through individual intentionality and then a collective intentionality.
You can hear the entire discussion at KUT.org. Dalia Jones, KUT News.
We don't need no water. We don't need no water. We don't need no water. Let that motherfucker burn, 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 burn. We don't need no water. Let that motherfucker burn.
Despite
fire started in the back of the house and then spread throughout. The owner says it burned for hours and more could have been done to limit the damage.
This used to be the kitchen nook right here.
This sprawling 3,700 square foot ranch on Outer Drive in Lincoln Park was all but reduced to rubble after a fire in late February. Pastor Terry Banks, the homeowner, accuses Lincoln Park firefighters of dragging their feet when it came to attacking the blaze.
They sent somebody down there to check the fire hydrant, the water, and they said, ain't no water coming out. And they sat there.
For how long?
About an hour.
An hour?
An hour.
You sure?
About an hour.
All the while, his home was burning. Banks says the firefighters eventually hooked up to another hydrant, and fire departments from E-Corps and Wyandotte came to help put out the flames. But the damage was done. In your professional opinion, could this home have been saved?
Very much so it could have been saved.
David Parker, a retired Detroit firefighter and friend of Banks, came to the home as it burned.
There was no tag on that hydrant then. There's no tag on it now. The attitude that was displayed, there was no passion and effort to help sustain the well-being of this, my friend, this pastor's home. And it was heart-wrenching to see something like that transpire.
Banks believes the fire department's response was racially motivated.
I overheard one say, we're not putting that fire out.
Nigga!
And who did he say that to?
He just said it to, I guess he was saying it out loud to one another, and they didn't.
I want to see justice for Pastor Banks. I want to see justice for his family. We want the answers from the mayor, answers from the fire chief, answers from the city attorney.
Lincoln Park's fire chief and city manager were unavailable for comment, but the city attorney says the fire department did all it could to save the Banks' home. He says firefighters had trouble getting through the copper ceiling that provided the house's radiant heating. As for Banks' claim about a firefighter making that racist comment, the city attorney says he does not believe that happened. The city attorney went on to say that the fire is not being called suspicious and that the home is not a total loss. In the meantime, Reverend W.J. Rideout is planning a demonstration in front of Lincoln Park City Hall. I'm Randy Wembley, and this is The Edge.
Allow me to apologize to other families formed through transracial adoption because I am deeply sorry that we suggested that interracial families are in any way funny or deserving of ridicule. On this program, we are dedicated to advocating for a wide diversity of families.
It was a poignant photo that melted hearts around the world. A sobbing child hugging a police officer in the aftermath of the Ferguson disturbances in 2014. Now that child, 15-year-old Devontae Hart, and the rest of his family, eight people in all, are presumed dead after the SUV they were traveling in was found at the foot of a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean in Northern California.
Nobody wants to get to the bottom of this more than the guy you're looking at right now. Why did this happen? How did this happen? And can we prevent it from happening again?
Devontae was one of six children adopted by Jen Hart and her spouse, Sarah. They appear to be living a hippie lifestyle on this sprawling property in Washington State. There's the family at a Bernie Sanders rally in 2016. But neighbors Bruce and Dana DeKalb say the adopted children would come knocking on their door begging for food.
Their daughter's telling us, please, 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 begging us not to make her go back and that they're abusing her. And then Devontae coming over here and telling us that, you know, he's being starved to death.
Last Friday, they alerted Child Protective Services. Social workers called at the house three times, but the family had left in a hurry. Now their SUV has been found at the foot of this 100-foot cliff, 500 miles away in Northern California. Police say there were no skid marks, just tire tracks in the dirt, leading to speculation that the death plunge was deliberate.
I was trying to help them and protect them, and this is the result.
Hart family friend Zippy Lomax.
It's really enticing to sort of jump to conclusions and imagine this was some crazy Thelma and Louise kind of like we're going out and we're taking these kids with us. That just doesn't square at all with the people that I knew.
The cop in that famous photo, Sergeant Brett Barnum, told Inside Edition, "The tragic news about Devontae and his family deeply saddens me. The short interaction with Devontae reinforced my love, passion, and duty in providing service to my community."
Context of white supremacy,
Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 31st, 2018. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have commentary, counter-racist suggestions, thoughts on any of the audio segments that we just heard. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I'm sure, or I hope people heard about the Devontae Hart situation. It was on NPR and the LA Times. Most of the mainstream media outlets covered the incident, the vehicle crash. They covered it because so many outlets covered the initial photograph from 2014. The first thing, do people remember Susan Smith, race soldier, white woman, killed her children? She killed her white racist children, then blamed it on a black person. Folks remember that? That's one thing that came to mind with that whole case. The other, for me, many things came to mind, but the other, for me, what came to mind, and that's why I played the snippet that I played before the news segment on what appears to be the death of Devontae Hart. It reminded me of Melissa Harris Perry, victim of white supremacy, and that would be a cowbell. Melissa Harris Perry in 2014, at the beginning of the year, January, same year that Devontae Hart hit, the photograph went viral. At the beginning of the year, about 8 months before that photograph, she gave her tearful apology. She had done some sort of end of the year, end of 2013 panel where they had been joking about Mitt Romney because his family had adopted a black child. He has a black grandson with an interesting name that I just cannot think of. But the name, I think, means like dark or black. Anybody, if you want counter racist cool point for the day, what is the name of Mitt Romney's black grandchild? I think it does have some significance within the context of white supremacy. Anyway, so she had been joking about this quote unquote transracial adoption at the end of 2013. At the beginning of 2014, whites were so outraged and had called for her to be fired and lynched and everything else. By the next week, 7 days later, she had to begin the program with this tearful apology. And you heard, so sorry to malign, you know, Mitt Romney and his family, and apology without reservation. And then to any of the transracial families out there, you know, we were wrong to suggest that there's anything wrong with you, meaning white people adopting non-white children, abducting non-white children, particularly black children. I blogged about that in 2014. I posted it on my Facebook page for people who didn't get a chance to read it. The great Dorothy Roberts, she's been a guest on this program three times. I quoted from her work, Shattered Bonds, which is a phenomenal text on racism, white supremacy, and child protective services that explains why it is so easy for whites, particularly white women, to come in and snatch black children from black attempted mothers and attempted fathers. Easily snatch children like nothing, but you can have whites like these white lesbians who abducted Devontae Hart. They can get children, be reported repeatedly for allegedly abusing these children, and they still got the children. Eight of them, in fact. They can have a whole house filled with abducted non-white children living a hippie lifestyle right here in Gus T's own Washington state. System of white supremacy. Last thing, also, I just thought it was significant, important that race soldiers their entertainment is so saturated with white supremacy culture, which is just about violence, death, and particularly terrorizing, plundering, raping, pillaging black people. Their entertainment is so filled with their culture of death that they even have a film for the Devante Hart situation. Like, oh, no, no, don't think this is some kind of Thelma and Louise situation. You even got a situation. You even got a film for a situation where maybe a white female tandem got together in a vehicle and drove off a cliff. Yep, we got that covered too. We thought about doing a film on that one. Blockbuster hit. Culture system of white supremacy. A few other things before we get to the callers. The COWS listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can visit my blog where the said blog post about Melissa Harris Perry's tearful apology in 2014. It is at racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will give you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested in the COWS, supported flood relief, all of the above. Huge thanks. I hope the program has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. If you want to support, nab any items from my wish list, the wish list at Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade. It is linked at my blog. I'll also Facebook it and tweet it during the live broadcast. Thanks to all the folks. Tremendous gratitude to all the folks who have nabbed items for Gus T. Again, I hope the broadcast is helping folks who listen in get an accurate understanding of what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, and things that we can and should be doing to solve this problem immediately. A couple other things, and then we will get to folks who dialed in. First up, we'll be here on Tuesday. I have spent so much time talking about yoga and practicing yoga. I was there this morning, 7:30 a.m. class, indeed with black female instructor. But on Tuesday, we should have a black female. She also is a yoga instructor, and she'll be talking about her yoga retreat that is exclusively for black people, non-white people, and why it's structured in that manner. Some of the experiences that she had attempting to practice yoga with whites, and how yoga has been helpful for her in her life. Looking forward to it. That should be this Tuesday evening. Check Black Talk Radio Network, Facebook for updates, all that jazz. But Tuesday evening, looking forward to that conversation quite a bit. I think that got recommended just because I had been doing so much chatting on air about yoga and the different experiences of white supremacy that I have had while practicing yoga in the presence of whites. Next, we had a victim who wrote in, thankfully, and said that they have been listening to the COWS for a number of years, and unfortunately, they do not know what the acronym VGQ stands for. I'm so thankful that they wrote in. I wish they had, you know, written in or called in years ago, long time ago, to get that clarified. I can only ask, emphatically request, if you are listening to the program and you don't understand something, if it's something that's said, if it's a stance that's taken on the program, like, you know, my position about not using the term fair or not using the term white privilege, if it's a term that you don't understand, tragic arrangement, anything, ask for clarification. We want to make sure that people have an accurate understanding of what is being said, why things are being said in that manner. Just make sure you go ahead and ask. I know with VGQ specifically, I don't think there are too many acronyms that we use on the program without being explained. I think coincidentally, I did just explain VGQ within the last 10 days. I think someone just, called in and said that they didn't know what it meant. And I explained, but what I will do, my new code, I will explain VGQ on a regular basis, whether people ask or not, just because that is an acronym that does get invoked. And I know people might be brand new listeners. Not all of us have read Mr. Fuller's work or are familiar. VGQ, Victims Guaranteed Qualified. It is a term created or concept created by Mr. Neely Fuller Jr., producejustice.com. Producejustice.com. You can pick up a copy of the books. But the concept, Victims Guaranteed Qualified, he created it basically to stop non-white people from getting into arguments with one another. It just means that, hey, any non-white person, just on the basis of being a victim of white terrorism, you can take any position that you want about racism, white supremacy, whether it exists, even if you take the position that there's no such thing as white supremacy, fine, no problem. You can take any position that you want, and that is your right. You are qualified to take that position as a result of being a victim. And the reason that he created this concept is to stop non-white people from getting into arguments with one another and wasting a lot of time having, you know, bickering sessions where we have a difference of opinion. We can have a difference of opinion. That's fine. We just want to stay focused on solving the problem. And you can have, you know, whatever your perspective is, that's fine. I have my perspective. If that means that we can't work together in solving the problem, that's fine too. We can work united, independent in going about solving this problem. The concept of VGQ. In fact, we've had Mr. Fuller on the program where he talked specifically about that concept and why he created it. You can go back in the archives and or you can get a copy of the book and read for yourself. Next, the segment where they were talking about school integration, I was reminded of the grandsister, Dr. Frances Kress-Welsing. She was on the program in 2012, specifically springtime 2012. I can pinpoint exactly. And she, it might have been 6 years to this very weekend, because I think it was Easter weekend. If I am not mistaken, I might have to go back and double check to see if the timing is lined up that nicely, but I think it might be. At any rate, she commented on how she, third generation physician, general and child psychiatrist, she talked about how she had worked with clients who were a part of that first group of black children to quote unquote integrate white schools. And she talked about the years of trauma that they experienced. And I remember specifically, she talked about, it was a black female. And she said that the little white terrorists, the little white race soldiers that she was in school with, that they took her in the bathroom and stuffed her head in the toilet while there was feces in the toilet, and they, you know, snatched her out, threw her on the ground or whatever. And the racist instructors at the school would not allow her to go home so that she could change her clothes and take a shower. And they made her stay in school for the remainder of the day with feces in her hair and everything for the years of trauma. But Dr. Welsing, she talked about that. I think about that every time that they bring out these tacky conversations that try to bestow some type of glory on all of this. Like, oh, this was wonderful. This was fantastic. And integration of school. Terrorism. That's all it was. That was one. The second thing, the statement, Janae Nelson from the NAACP's legal defense team, when she said, I think everyone knew that once we remove the barriers of segregation, whatever that means, from public schools, from children, that would forever change the course of how Americans interacted with one another, how they viewed each other, how they perceived the humanity of each other. for that statement to be made, like in 2018, when they have so many reports, you could build a whole library talking about how in the last 60 years, schools have been what they call resegregated. They're back to the same level or worse than what it was in like 1960, 50, 60 years ago, with all of those reports. And then all of the other incidents of white terrorism. I didn't even play the report about the lacrosse team at Virginia Tech this week, where they were, you know, got in trouble for their N-word rants and all of that. All of the other incidents of white terrorism, for someone to make that statement, VGQ, victims guaranteed qualified. I think Ms. Nelson is a non-white person. Next, that segment on the 50-year anniversary of Seattle's chapter of the Black Panther Party. For people who don't know, Gus T. Renegade, I'm in Seattle. I've been here for a while now. In fact, I've been here so long, I was here for the 40-year anniversary of the Seattle Black Panther chapter. And man, I can give you one anecdote. I think I might have shared this before. I can give you one anecdote that it succinctly captures a lot of my experiences, feelings, thoughts, assessments about racism, white supremacy, and particularly my experiences in conversing, exchanging views with other Black people, either in person or Skype, phone, whatever it happens to be. During the 40-year anniversary, they had a lot of posters, events, lectures all over Seattle for the 40-year anniversary. This is 2008, and this is significantly, that was the election year. That was the year that President Obama, or yeah, that was the year Obama won the election. So there was a lot of things going on to influence, you know, this 40-year anniversary. So during the spring, about this time, they had a meeting on the University of Washington campus, and Aaron Dixon, who you just heard in that audio segment, he was the featured speaker, and they did it up, man. This was at the art gallery at the University of Washington, right next to Odegaard Library, for people who know the campus, which is probably very few of you. And they had cheese, they had wine, they had hors d'oeuvres. I mean, they did it up. It was a significant number of people, more than, I'd say definitely more than 50 people. I was in attendance. I think back of the bus started the cows together. I think he might have been there. Some other folks were in attendance. Not a whole lot of Black people. They do the talk. They finish up. They go to serve the cheese. Aaron Dixon is down. He's talking it up with people. And so I go to Mr. Dixon and I ask a question. What do I tell people? Make sure you're attending these type of events when they have conversations locally. It's an opportunity to exchange views. It's an opportunity to share information with other non-white people, with other Black people. Emmy was just talking about the importance of that. You never know who might hear you give a definition of racism, white supremacy. Ask a question. You can question whites at these events. So I go up to Mr. Dixon and I say, you know, there's a lot of white people here. Do you have any concerns or suspicions that, man, I don't know, this might not be the most constructive thing, or even why so many whites would be present at an event like this and happy, seeming, you know, they're having a good time doing it up. Why would that be the case to celebrate and cheer about the antics of this rebellious Negro group from 40 years ago? And he said, oh, no, brother. And I almost get suspicious every time someone calls me brother. He says, oh no, brother, you've got it all wrong, man. Things have changed so much and times are so different. You know, their attitude has changed a lot and things are just a lot different from where they were at that time. Like, you know, the folks that are here now, you know, yeah, they celebrate, you know, they want to recognize, they think this is important and blah, blah, blah. And so he gives his response, and mind you, he had just told us during 2008, he had just told the audience about how he had a firearm, self-defense, that was in the audio segments. He had a firearm, and he thinks, his theory is that a part of the COINTELPRO program that we also heard about, a part of that program, someone tampered with his firearm. He said he cleaned his gun. He took meticulous care. He had a code for his firearm. He was meticulous about it. He thinks someone tampered with his gun to cause it to backfire. He thinks that's what happened. Anyway, he had just told us about all this, being armed. I'm not, you know, coming up. I wasn't calling names. I wasn't calling them crackers. These no good white devils. And I wasn't saying any of that. I wasn't saying we need to kill them. I wasn't talking about guns. All I said is, you know, do you have any suspicions about so many whites being here and seemingly gleeful about, you know, yeah, tell us more about what the Panthers did back in the good old days. And so after he finished his first response, and I just looked at him, I said, I don't know. I see the same problem from, you know, 40 years ago. And I just find it hard to believe that these whites, even the ones that are here, are not dedicated to maintaining that system of racism. And he gave me one of those looks. I can only say I am sad that I'm very familiar with this look. The look that you get from, particularly from a black person, that's like, oh, you are one of those crazy black people. And I remember, because it was like he kind of leaned back. And I remember kind of even stepping out of myself. I think that might be a metaphor. I remember pausing to just reflect on what was happening in the moment and thinking, this is someone who carried a firearm, just talked about armed self-defense, which I'm not opposed to at all. But I mean, people would say that that's what they call militant. Black Panther Party, what they call a radical organization. All I said is, do you have any suspicion about the whites that are here and why they would be happy about all of this? And I am the crazy, like, woo. It was just, I will never forget this moment. Just the look on his face, where I was, the time, I will never forget this moment. Just like, wow, I cannot believe that I'm talking to a Black Panther member and I am the crazy one. I am the one with the extreme view here. Like, wow. Okay. And he just looked at me and he said, yeah, brother, I just don't think you understand. And we'll have to talk more and blah, blah, blah. And all this. I was stymied. I accepted his response. VGQ. I accepted his response. I turned around. I did not have any cheese. I left. Less than 24 hours later, I said they had lots of ceremonies at this time. I heard Bobby Seale. Less than 24 hours later, he was at a different facility. I heard him speak. I walked out into the sun. It was about this time of year. I walked out into the sun. It was a Friday morning. There was a suspected racist white woman. She came out of the event. She just heard Mr. Seale speak. And she said, wow, he was funny and entertaining. I will also not forget that moment either. Less than 12 hours after my conversation with Mr. Dixon, and I said, I am retarded. I'm a victim of white supremacy. Mr. Bobby Seale also has VGQ. But one thing, I'm going to work really hard to make sure that whites, when all is said and done, they will not describe Gus T as funny and entertaining. That is my personal story with the Black Panther Party, Seattle chapter specifically, and my participation in some of their anniversary events. I have not seen all of that for the 50-year anniversary. I was on the University of Washington campus just within the past few days. I did not see any Black Panther paraphernalia, certainly not the level that I saw in 2008, and I have not seen any announcements for any of the type of hoopla that they had 10 years ago. That said, we will get to the callers. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. And actually, that sound clip, I did learn one thing that did give me better insight on the exchange that I had with Mr. Dixon, and it corroborates something that I've said for years, that the context of white supremacy would not exist if Gus T had grown, if I had been born in Seattle, Washington. I've been here for a number of years at this point, but I was not born here. That is hugely significant. Mr. Dixon said that I think, if not his best friend, some of his best friends were white. I think he said he didn't agree with everything that Bobby Seale said because he was saying cracker and all. I didn't say cracker when I talked to him. But he said that his best friend, I think, growing up was white or whatever. How could that not be growing up in Seattle? There are so few black people, as they said in the clip, even less now. How could it would have to be the case that you would have to have all kinds of white pals growing up if you were born here or if you were here doing your formative childhood years, as they say. And I think that that has a huge impact on how you view racism, white supremacy, what it means to be classified as white when you have those deep personal connections, emotional attachments to racist man, racist woman, racist child. I've said that for years, two of the most dangerous words to be together in the English language, white friend. But yes, that was an interesting bit of insight. If folks could take about 5 minutes to share your commentary, thoughts, counter-racist suggestions, that would be spectacular. Make sure everybody has at least one chance to speak. If you have additional comments, questions, you can share once everyone has had one turn to speak. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be great. Just really helps preserve the audio quality of the broadcast and helps everybody. They don't have to fight over unnecessary noise when they are trying to speak. You can just unmute yourself when you're ready to speak again. If we could not use metaphors for this broadcast specifically, I've concluded that racist, one of the ways that they practice deception, racism, is using metaphors. They'll use comparisons, metaphors, analogies, where they will insist that these two entities are the same, and frequently that is not the case at all. Non-white people, victims of white supremacy, we've been exposed to this behavior for a number of years, centuries really, and many of us, Gus T. Renegade included, we are still learning, so we've not come to conclusions on some topics. Sometimes we are lacking logic to explain our thoughts, and we will substitute and use a metaphor or an analogy. Often that just adds to confusion. If we could be explicit, direct about what we would like to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about that. Sometimes we just need to think a little more to get the logic to accurately reflect what we want to say. No problem there. You just take a bit of time to think and then express your thoughts clearly. Thank you kindly. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. If you have commentary, feel free.
Peace, Gus. How are you?
Right, poorly.
Good evening. Me too, as well. Man, Martin Luther King, why don't they always leave out the point that, and I could be mistaken, but didn't Coretta Scott King win a suit that proved that the United States government was culpable in his murder, Gus?
Yes, they did.
I think she won like a dollar or something like that. I mean, they really slapped her. I mean, no metaphor. Even though Snoop's website would say that's false, but I saw the documentary where that actually happened. The man shot in the back seven times, Mr. Clark. This reminded me of Walter Scott, where he was shot in the back, eight times, running away, and then the cop threw, the taser by him a little later. And it just so happened that Dominican brother had footage of it, and he was bold enough to put that footage out. I would like to see if he's still in the country. But it's just that this man seemed like he was climbing into a window or trying to knock on the window to get his grandmother's attention because they couldn't hear the bell in the front, and he had his cell phone. I guess he was calling them. But the thing that stood out to me was the story that they initially went with was that they were tracking someone who committed a robbery or whatever. They had the actual helicopter above. Now, I know when they're tracking someone with on foot, they usually have the light beaming on the person. I mean, I've watched Cops way too many times. How did they get this confused? So I just think that, that kind of got me. Israel, I call it isn't real because it never existed. It was created on May 14th, 1948. I always remember that date. And they have the nerve to expel anyone from a place that they currently occupy from another group of people that already occupy land that didn't belong to them. It's just terrible. Isn't Real was created and is the headquarters of the most, it was created by and is the headquarters of the most racist and the most powerful organization on this planet called the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits. And that to me, eight weighs in. They didn't, what did they say? Ain't putting that nigga fire out. Firefighters, once again, popping up. Firefighters have so much power in this instance. I mean, when we talk about the Allen Iverson, when he said, man, that judge got a lot of power. I mean, when you're standing there watching your house burn and the firefighters are standing there for an hour letting it happen, they got a lot of power in that position. And the fact that this black pastor has this white lawyer pretty much call him a liar, say that that's not what was said, I thought that was terrible. Mitt Romney, Kevin Kiwan, or whatever, James Romney. And I always remember, because he had, remember that picture, Gus, where all the other boys, he has a bunch of grandkids, and all of them were wearing blue, and they had this one, this little boy in pink. But it's it comes from Irish, which is white people, Celtic, which is black people, origin. And it could mean either little dark people, or little dark one, or dark poet by the sea. And that's the meanings of that name. I also hate the word fear. It has too many meanings. It can mean a carnival. It can mean light, white, good. And then you can spell it differently, F-A-R-E, and it means a fee, or F-E-A-R, and it means you're scared. I never liked that word either. I mute my line.
Appreciate that. I knew Thomas in New York would get Mr. Romney's grandson's name, which, as I said, was significant. And I did want to make sure I include, we had a listener, she wrote in, metaphors, sometimes whites, metaphors, I think, just reveal more truth than they intend. So we had a listener, she said, or she wrote, my grandmother is in the hospital. Suspected white supremacists stopped by to take her vitals. She refused and went back to sleep. He states, oh, well, let sleeping dogs lie. Continuing, so far, listener, continuing writing. So far, I've been hugged by an overweight female nurse, and an anti-sexual aide told me his grandfather lived to be 90 and he hated anyone who wasn't white. He told me he recently visited his grave and noticed a spot that was dug next to his had a black woman's name. He says he laughed and said, serves you right, grandpa. Medical apartheid. And Dorothy Roberts, Killing the Black Body. We've done a lot of works. Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. You can just pile them up. Hundreds of Interlaced Fingers, Dr. Vanessa Grubbs. Pile them up. Lots of work in that department. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings to everyone on the line. I did listen to the clips, however, I definitely feel I need to go back and listen to the archive when it's posted to get a full understanding of it. I'm sick, so pardon. But a piece of something I'm trying to implement in my code, I had a discussion with a non-white female, so-called black female, about the phrase, like, someone lost their life, when it refers to someone being killed or murdered. And in an effort to avoid conflict with this non-white person, I didn't take my stance. I didn't present my stance in as assertive manner as I should have, but I was basically debating the fact that we shouldn't say that someone lost their life if they're killed. Like, what I hear when someone says someone lost something is that it's that person's fault. They have some type of culpability or some type of blame in regards to losing it. You lose your keys. You lose, like, you know, pens. That's your fault. you don't lose your life. Your life is either taken from you or it just ends. But in regards to how in the book club, the current book you were reading, The Hate U Give, I noticed that they say that a lot about the black male character Khalil, like, oh, he lost his life even though clearly he was murdered. I think that this, just implementing that into my personal code and maybe the suggestion to others, is helping keep perspective that there's a reason why that person is no longer alive. And it's not their fault. So I definitely wanted to suggest that. And one thing about the comment that you made, Gus, after the clips, with regarding the cheese, it made me think of the Boondocks, and I believe it was a line by Grandpa, and he was like talking about the so-called quote new white man, and said, "You give a white man cheese, and he turns into Mr. Rogers." So maybe it was the cheese that caused them to not be so, or to be more comfortable in that with the meeting that you went to. But like I said, I have to go back and listen to the clips. Thank you for listening, and meet my wife.
Indeed, indeed. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Hello to everyone, and thank you for taking my call. This is Red in Nevada. The first thing I'll say about the clips, and then I have some information about more from the Las Vegas Review Journal. The one thing that I did notice about the Devante Hart segment was when the reporter, he described the Ferguson uprisings. He said it was during the Ferguson disturbances. And I know, like, before when other segments were played, they'll say, you know, disturbances. They won't say or riot. They put it in a way, whites will put it in a way to where it was something that was unjustified, basically. There's no reason for these people to be upset. So that was the first thing. And then I know there was the clips about, like, the gun legislation, what have you. A couple of weeks ago, also in the same paper that I've been reading, they did, like a full page, and it says what it takes to buy a gun in 15 countries. And it just goes through 15 different countries and what it all takes to buy the gun. The most lenient country is, they describe it, they describe Yemen. It says go to a gun market or find a gun seller online and buy the gun. That's it. And then the next one is the place, you know, known as the United States. Pass the background check, and then buy the gun. And then it just goes from there. And the most restrictive one is actually in Japan. You have to take a written exam. You have to get a doctor's note, go through training. And then some of these countries, you can't even still have the gun in your home. You have to leave it somewhere, sign it out when you want to use it, just all these different things. So just wanted to mention that. Another thing that I had noticed in the paper was that they're saying that Nevada's meth deaths are the nation's highest. And so now, I guess, like, the white drug addicts, they're doing better as far as not using heroin, but now they're going to methamphetamine, and it can also, and they say that not only is it lethal just by itself, it's lethal because it could still also be mixed with fentanyl. So there's that. And I guess the last thing, or actually two more things. There was another story about how, in the school systems here, they had prosecuted within the past couple of years, or are in the process of charging and or prosecuting 18 different people for different sexual crimes against children. And unfortunately, at least they didn't have the pictures on, like, the front pages, but in the other page, like the continuance of the story, they had different pictures of all the people who have been arrested. And nine of the 10 of them seemed like they were black males. And then you, it at least showed, like, for the 8 of the people who have been prosecuted since 2016, when they were arresting all these different school employees, they would show their charges. And of course, like for the 8 of, I think there were 2 white men and then 6 black males. And the all of the black males, they were required to not only do jail, some type of jail time, but they were also required to do be on the sex registry. And there was one where a black male and a white man basically committed the same crime. It was basically having sex with a child and something else. And the white man, all he was still convicted and had to serve time, but he also did not. He was not required to be on the sex registry. And the black male who did the same thing got a little bit more time and then also was required to be on the sex registry. So it's nothing, of course, that that shocked me or anything, but I was just surprised that they actually at least put them side by side. So maybe more confused people might be able to see that, and maybe that'll help them with their understanding. And thank you for allowing me to share. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Red. In Nevada, great job keeping up with the news and all the different updates on whites killing themselves in new ways with the drug epidemic. And then the situation with the teachers, apparently, that have been charged with molesting, and then most of them were black males. That reminds me of the teacher situation in Atlanta, where they charged a bunch of the black teachers with cheating on the exams. Also wanted to get in really quick when Thomas in New York mentioned that the terrorism, white terrorism that's happening in Israel. Dr. Francis Kress-Welsing, White Genetic Annihilation. That was the snippet that I began that audio segment with. They said they were specifically targeting single black males, specifically with the removal effort that they were carrying out, white genetic annihilation. And that sounds like that good old black male privilege once again. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, just a few things. First off, this is from NYC, from Brooklyn. NRA probably has more Klansmen than we ever could even imagine, Klansmen and Klan women. I'm curious to see what the rest of the callers and anybody else of the listeners think about that. Stephen Clark, my heart goes out to his family. But this is a clear indication of exactly what Dr. Francis Kress-Welsing was pointing out as far as black males are the greatest threat to white genetic annihilation. And I'm wondering in this aspect, it hurts in this aspect coming from myself. I have 2 black male sons, and this is one of my greatest fears. Austin, Texas bombing here in NYC, barely any news of it, barely any news of the racial aspect of it at all. NPR did a little bit of something on it. Outside of that, nothing. None of the major networks hit it at all. As far as the fire goes, I would really like to hear what retired firefighter has as far as an opinion on this, because here, I don't know it's just the same anywhere else, but we've had an issue with firefighters and the situation. They actually got a lawsuit here in NYC back in the day because they did not hire any black males. So they literally had a campaign trying to hire, quote unquote, non-white males into the fire department. I'm curious to see what retired firefighter has to say about that in regards to that. I'll mute my line. That's pretty much all. Thank you.
Appreciate that. other folks who dialed in, if we've not heard from you at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Hopefully everyone's having the best evening they can have. I caught just the end of the clips,
But the clip about little Devontae Hart, of course, that was sad. And I told my mother, I guess I had a similar situation to you had when you were talking to Mr. Dixon, but it was over the phone. I told her, I said, I wouldn't be surprised if that happened on purpose. Oh, everything you saw racial, blah, 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 this, that, and the other. This. I was like, you don't know what people will do. And sure enough, here you come with the clip. With the proof that something may have happened. I wasn't there. And then I guess there's an anti-sexual component that no one brought up, because I think the parents in this situation were both female. But I guess you just have to, you know, and there was another little story she told me about some little kid that was afraid of their shadow, and she said people were laughing at it. And, you know, I asked her, well, was the little kid black? And she said, no, they were white. And I fell out. Well, excuse me, not fell out. I started laughing very hard. You know, it kind of burst out of my mouth, the laughter. I said, even a little white child was afraid of the black shadow. And she didn't think that was funny either. But I'm her only child, so she'll have to keep talking to me. Thank you.
That's funny. Hilarious. Other folks who die. My heart goes out to them is a metaphor. Make sure I didn't forget. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, if we haven't heard from you, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
Right, poorly.
I'm calling from out of Houston. And speaking of that Austin bomber situation, Houston is about 2 hours away from Austin and is barely getting coverage down here. The Stephen Clark situation, like, that's really messed up, and it's really sad. My heart goes out to his family as well. But earlier in the week, they did cover the Alton Sterling case on the news when they presented the verdict of the officers that got away with murdering this man. And as they were reporting it, the newscaster mentioned, it just felt like she just had to mention that he had a gun in his front pocket. And I'm like, is that the reason why it's justified for them murdering, because they claim he had a gun in his front pocket? I'm like, that's the craziest thing in the world, and I'm so sick of these people. It'll make you lose it, man. And Red in Nevada, she mentioned something about methamphetamines. I mean, the meth. There was a councilman down here, I think his name was Larry Green. He just mistakenly, quote unquote mistakenly, overdosed and died off of methamphetamines and chlorine he accidentally overdosed. And when they interviewed everybody from the city council, no one known of him to have any type of drug addictions or any type of drug background. And he just mysteriously died. And I did just a little small research on him. And the mayor of Houston, he's also a black man. They were, getting ready to do some things down in Houston, in another on the south part of town. And it was just crazy that it was just all of a sudden that he died. And I think that's all I had. I'll
mute my line. Just in the interest of use of correct words, as opposed to saying it's crazy that he's died, I would say that it's suspicious. That might be a better, more accurate word choice. That is something I do try to emphasize on this broadcast, making sure we're using the most accurate terms possible to describe when these types of things happen. If that makes sense. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers and the listeners. This is The Voice from Florida. I did want to say that I've been away for a while because I had to undergo surgery for a brain aneurysm. But I did want to tell everybody out here in South Florida that there is a wonderful doctor that I researched before my surgery, who is a non-white black doctor by the name of Brandon Davis. Phenomenal doctor, and representation matters a lot, because when I'm a non-white black male, and I have dreadlocks, and I remember when he was talking to me a bit before my procedure, and I was just breathing a lot of confidence and energy in him, and telling him that, you know, I believe in him. You know, I feel good about him after I researched him. And, you know, we had a great convo. And the thing about it, he was telling me that when he is going to do the procedure, that he was going to bring the scar and go behind my hairline opposed to in the front. And the reason why I really wanted to bring this up to the people is because I believe if I had got a non-black, white, or other doctor, that they don't take the consideration of knowing that, you know, in our culture, that the hairline, you know, we're real picky about our hairline. And him knowing that he's a black doctor, he's a black person, I'm a black person, he understands the concept, he understands, you know, without even that basic communication. So phenomenal guy. I told him that whenever he goes out there and does meetings and, you know, needs somebody to come up and, you know, vouch for his work, I'll be that person. And, you know, we have a good relationship since. So that happened. I've been away from the broadcast for a minute, so I just wanted to let you guys know about that. And I'm just happy. I love all you guys. All the information has been great. And I'm just glad that I'm back. Reborn again, and part of the broadcast. I do want to get into the first clip with the NCAA. It made me think about LeVar Ball when he wanted to start up his own league to start paying the players, because he noticed that a lot of these players, you know, basically are being used for their services. And a lot of these owners and people behind the scenes are getting a lot of, and that's one thing about the clip that I love so much, that you get clips that are very detailed, and they were breaking that. I didn't even know it was a lot of people that make that much money behind the scenes off of these black players. So I pretty much thank you for that clip, because that was like new information that I've got. The second one was with the young girl from North Star Academy. I just feel, and this is no disrespect, but I just feel like she's just confused and misled, because she was using words in context that kind of works against black progress, that I feel. That's just my thing, when she uses words like intersexuality and you know, just other words that she was just using that, It just feels like the March for Our Lives is just to replace Black Lives Matter, because anything that is black seems to be demonized. I don't know metaphor or what, but I don't feel like, you know, I just feel like they're using black children in and highlighting them, putting them on this platform, and just misdirecting the whole mission. And when I was listening to her the whole time, I was like, I see why they are putting her on this platform and making people think that this is the direction that we need to go in. I want to say, I say to Miss Brown, the non-white black lady that passed away, you know, with the Board of Education. I know probably going through her mind before she passes, I know she had to be thinking like, man, if nothing's changed, I don't know if this was a good, I don't know what her thoughts were. It would be nice to know what her thoughts were. But to me, if I felt like I was in her shoes, I'd be, you know, transitioning with the mind frame of things still haven't gotten any better and it's just getting worse. That would be my thoughts. The COINTELPRO on the Black Panther. The COINTELPRO on Dr. King. It reminded me of the COINTELPRO on the Black Panther and the destruction, how they used it, and the horrific death of Fred Hampton. So, and nowadays they got the BIE, Black Identity Extremist Movement. So I feel like that's just coming right back into play. And it's going to be a lot of
30 seconds.
When you look at a lot of, 30 seconds. I'm sorry. I just feel like it's a lot of people that's going to, you know, be victims again of that same thing. When you look at Darren Seals and everybody else, but that's about it. I'll comment later. Thank you.
Appreciate that. The voice. I'm very glad to hear that things worked out well with your medical procedures, Black self-respect, supporting the Black physician who, you know, helped things go well. That is phenomenal that you were able to do research. And then, you know, the importance, as you said, of Black doctors matter. I think Emmy and some of our other listeners, that's the direction that they are pursuing. Dr. Francis Quest Relsing, physician, even France Fanon, even though I'm, you know, the wretched of the earth is not one of my favorites. He was also a physician. Black doctors matter for a lot of the reasons that you pointed out, the voice and more. So I'm ecstatic to hear that things went well, to have you back participating. I hope it's constructive information, and that is phenomenal. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, in her shoes, that is a metaphor. Before I forget, other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, everyone. I heard some clips on the Black Panther Party. One thing that was admitted by some of the members of the Black Panther Party over the years was of the inconsistencies that would take place from chapter to chapter. And I think you experienced some of that in your contact with the Seattle chapter. I don't know anything. I don't know that much about the Seattle chapter. I'm just saying that it was common that within the Black Panther Party, it had inconsistencies in how things, which is nothing new with, you know, just about any attempt that non-white people have, especially non-white Black people have, dealing with a lot of young people. And also there was a lot of inconsistencies as far as to the point of even violence amongst each other within the organization itself, from chapter to chapter in some cases, the West Coast and the East Coast type of thing. So what I was listening to, you were talking about the understanding of the one of the members. I'm not surprised about it at all. Not surprised. Even the relationship that they had with white people is not unusual as far as what I've heard myself. I heard someone mentioning about that they was wondering on what my comments were on. I think it was one of your clips on a fire.
Yes, sir. There was in Michigan, there was a Black male pastor, his house, he had a house fire, and he reported that the firefighters sat for about an hour and made no effort to put the blaze out, made some sort of excuse saying that the fire hydrant didn't work, even though there was no sign on the hydrant saying that there was a problem or effort to fix it. And then he also reported that he overheard one of the firefighters saying that we're not going to put that nigger's fire out.
Yeah, well, I mean, onto the issue, I would say that that has to be some level of criminal negligence in itself, because even if a fire hydrant is not working properly, the fire truck itself has a amount of water in it that in most cases it can what we call knock down the initial amount of the fire, even on a call where it is a substantial fire. Basically, what takes place, and it's kind of like universal, just about everywhere. The first arriving unit on a call gives the type of building, single family residence. Single-story family residence, visible flames and smoke, code one. That means that because there's a certain amount of vehicles that go on the call, and that first arriving unit, based on what I just said, that whole assignment of people will come. So, and you're talking about at least two fire trucks. And I'm sure that the fire trucks had water in them. And like I say, even if a fire hydrant, there's plenty of other options. There's more than one fire hydrant. And if anyone wondered on why fire trucks have holes on sitting on top of the rear of the truck, is because it can lay out a line that can go from one fire truck to the other. It can extend from another fire hydrant. I'm sure it was another fire hydrant that was somewhere in close proximity to the house. There's all other kind of options based on what I'm stating. So I mean, basically what that is it was a act of racism, and it can be also considered to be criminal neglect. Anything else on that?
Hopefully
I was clear enough.
If other folks, I guess if they would like input from retired firefighter on that particular clip, his thoughts about how that was handled, or the speculation that this was an act of racism by the firefighters to allow this black male's house to burn down, feel free. He's here. I'm sure he'd be willing to answer question. Was that it? Did you have anything else you were going to share, sir?
That was the only thing that I had to share as far as your report on the Seattle Black Panther Party, the Seattle chapter. Right. And I heard the request from one of the callers.
Gotcha. Context of white supremacy. Any other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Ivy.
Greetings, Mr. Renegade. Greetings to all the callers on the line. Welcome back to The Voice. I love you, too. I missed you. I listen to the Cows all the time, and so I've been actually thinking about you a lot lately, thinking about how I haven't heard from you in a while. Thanks, Mr. Renegade, for the blackmail privilege layup that you gave me, because I've been thinking about how, black male boys and men are victimized more than any group on the planet, and, just the mass incarceration, the murders on videotape, the murders not on videotape, getting less jobs and less loans and less ability to open up businesses and less housing and everything else than everyone, and being criminalized all the time, being talked about as criminals. The public discourse on black males is criminality, that you guys are thugs and rapists and gangsters and, you know, all this, all these lies. And it seems like every time somebody opens their mouth about black males, it's usually negative. And in my view, I could be incorrect, what I've seen is that black male boys and men have been literally left for dead, meaning that they have been left to die and to be consumed by all of the victimization that they endure, and just the way that they're criminalized and all of that is psychological terrorism, is psychological abuse, it's verbal abuse. Whenever they are victimized, they are blamed for their victimization, and they get, you know, murdered or anything else. It's, oh, you know, so-and-so was accused of rape, or they had a picture with their middle fingers up, or holding a gun, or, you know, just whatever. And from what I have observed and what I believe, and again, I could be incorrect, that no one cares about black males. No group stands up for them. I see everyone standing up for women and for, excuse me for the metaphor, supporting women, supporting children, supporting animals who are victimized. I see a plethora of men supporting women who are victimized, who are harmed. And one such person that everybody on this line is familiar with who does that is Gus T. Renegade. Gus T. Renegade does not allow men or males to speak before women. He has said that the harming of women and the marginalization of women, that men need to get away from that. And I think that that's wonderful. Tupac had a song, Keep Your Head Up, and he talks about we need to kill for our women, heal our women, be real to our women. I don't know of any song like that for men, for black male boys and black men. That statement about kill for our women and all these things, that can be applied to black male boys and black men 100-fold, because they are harmed and mistreated more than anyone. And even the people that are marching and who are talking about Alton Sterling and Philando Castile and Tamir Rice and every other male child and black man who has been murdered and has all these different victimizations, they are marching and talking about these individuals because they care about black people, not because they care about black men or black male boys or any of that. And I'm not blaming anyone. I know that that is a part of our victimization. We have been conditioned to care about everyone else except for them. And people are talking about children. I'm almost done. People are talking about children and animals and all that and all of that because they may be women, or they may have children, or they may have animals. And so it's all about, and for those reasons, and it's also because they care about children, they care about animals, and they care about women. It isn't just because they are also vulnerable to these harms. Whereas when it comes to black male boys and black men, it's because you care about black people in general, because you may be black or something like that. That's the only reason. It's not because you care about black male boys and black men and that you just hate to see them being treated like that. But when it comes to other groups, again, children and women and animals, you care about those people and those animals and things like that. And I just want to encourage, last thing that I'm going to say, VGQ to everyone. You don't have to follow this suggestion, but my suggestion is that, you know, the women on the line and just, you know, non-black people and just people of different groups, that they will promote just the care and the love of black male boys and black men, because they deserve to be loved and cared for and defended just as much as women, just as much as children, and just as much as animals. And that's all I had for now. And I'll mute my line. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And thanks, Gus. And yeah, I'll mute my line.
Context of white supremacy, number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Any folks that we missed completely, if you have commentary, line should be open. Please do not wait till the last minute. Make sure I get that in. We have less than an hour left in the broadcast. So if you think you have a question, comment, anything that you want to contribute, go ahead and get your hand up. Don't wait until the last few minutes. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, line should be open.
Gus, can I say one question? I'm sorry, go ahead. It's okay. I'll say it later.
Okay. We'll make sure not to forget Ivy. The male caller that just spoke up.
Okay. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Salam alaikum to the host, to the callers, to the platform. And, you know, what I wanted to speak about, the last caller made some good comments about caring for the whole black family as a unit and not leaving any member of the family out, even if it's the black son or the black male. And I think that's just as beautiful as when black men care for black women and children. So I think that there's balance in that. Another thing is, one of the major areas of people's activity is religion or spirituality, which people dispute about, are they both included with each other or what? But the reason I say that is because we're in a holiday, alleged holiday, in the system of racism and white supremacy that has been, you know, an issue for our community for some time, because our people struggle with understanding, is this information true? What's true about it? Why are we being given pictures of a white person and we're being told that this person is the son of God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that the more black people that are willing to engage in VGQ conversation with black self-respect as it concerns the area of religion, we can start to help ourselves with the issues that we face, that like Easter coming up for some of our people tomorrow. And they would think that the creator of the universe is a white person, or they've been taught a program with some type of idolatry or sorcery or whatever we want to call it, that the creator of the universe, what made air, water, us, whatever, is a white person. And so I see that being the issue for our people. But I also see on the opposite side of that is the hypocrisy that we would naturally have from being angry and being oppressed by the system of racism, white supremacy, which is just another form of terrorism. And you will notice people don't want to engage in the conversation about who, what, when, and where really is our creator. And what can we really do as a group to help ourselves get out of the system of racism, white supremacy, and have life and live on the earth like we want to live. But if we think we're going to do that without including our creator in a very detailed manner in what we're doing, then I just think that that itself is a delusion in the black community, that if we don't get over it, then some people will not be where some other people are. Maybe some other black people will excel other black people because they will say, you know, we're willing to engage in this conversation and talk about a white man not being God, or a black person not being God, or a statue. And then so we can try to create a way of life for our people. So that's all I wanted to say. And Assalamu alaikum to all of the people on the line, all the victims of the racism, white supremacy that we know and that we don't know, to the host and to the platform.
Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, lines should be open. Proceed. Any folks
can there? I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Sorry about that, Gus. Didn't mean to interrupt you. Peace to you and peace to everybody on the line. How are you, Gus?
Right, poorly.
I can definitely understand. It is so glad to be back with all of you and to have you back, Gus. I must admit that it was somewhat difficult not to have the cows during those long months, but it is always great to have you back. This is V from Central New York. My comments will be very brief today, but since it was brought up during the conversation, tomorrow, of course, is Easter. And a couple of months ago, I saw a very interesting and compelling presentation put on by former Cows guest, Anthony Browder, who spoke about Easter and why it was never on one specific day. It is because it always falls the first Sunday after the first full moon, after the spring equinox. So that's just a little bit of information we should hold tight to because, but understand, because we are dealing with holidays that are astronomically based, not, as they say, religious or theologically based. So we must understand that and do some possible research into why Easter is important if it's astrological. That brings me to the last point. One of the points that Gus always makes is that we need to read. And there is something that I'm noticing about a lot of our people in our community. Most of us don't read very well, and we don't comprehend what we do read very deeply. This, of course, has been a plan of racists and white supremacists, both actually, but since the time of slavery. So maybe in the next couple of years, many of us who are teachers, we should take it upon ourselves to rectify that situation. Everybody who participates in this contemporary call-in, or excuse me, in this compensatory call-in show has amazing ideas, and I've always noticed that. Many of us, though, don't often know how to take those ideas and bring them into reality as concrete solutions that are making a difference every day where we live. So I encourage everybody to look up some books on project development and on educational development, because both of those subjects will help us take our ideas and create programs surrounding them to help our communities. It is time that we become active in the change that we see in our minds. So again, thanks to Gus, peace to everybody who is listening, and peace to everybody who will listen in the future. I will mute my line.
Appreciate that. Thank you so much for dialing in, New York. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed. Did we miss anybody? Yep. Any folks?
Can I be heard?
Yep. Go ahead, Mr. Steele.
Awesome.
Howdy doody, everybody. It's Ken Steele, and I am calling from Chino, California at the moment. And I wanted to, I guess, draw attention to how peculiar these March for Our Lives protests are. I don't know if anybody has noticed this, but it seems as though the conversation about this March for Our Lives is slowly but surely evolving into a discussion about preventing Black people from owning guns. If you've been paying attention to the protests or the developments surrounding the March for Our Lives movement, you'll notice that one of the main proponents of the campaign is a character named David Hogg. And this Hogg character is in a, I guess, a feud of sorts with another suspected white supremacist character from the television. Her name is Laura Ingraham. And one of the, I guess, main points that this Daniel Hogg keeps pointing out or keeps saying is that this Laura Ingraham character needs to talk about quote-unquote urban crime instead of talking about, you know, these March for Our Lives characters themselves. She needs to focus her attention on urban crime. And I've seen this Hogg character use that term on a number of occasions. And anytime they're talking about Black people, and I think the, I guess the impetus or what they started to talk about Black people for was there was, I guess, a mention or an observation that Black people are suffering from gun violence as well. And this March for Our Lives isn't adequately addressing that. And then they started switching the narrative from talking about the fact that there are so many white supremacists allowed to walk around with guns and to murder other suspected white supremacists in their schools. The conversation is now just shifting almost exclusively to one where they say, well, what about black-on-black crime? And it's something that I just want everybody to pay attention to and to just make note of. Another thing that I think is worth mentioning is that recently white supremacists are going online and they are defending the pair of suspected white supremacists that killed all of the adopted children, the adopted Black children that they were, I guess, guardians of by driving them off a cliff. I made one mention or I made one post about this incident on my wall, and a number of suspected white supremacists were coming on the page and or coming on my page and trying to change the narrative and trying to sow, you know, doubt in the minds of anybody reading my page that these children were killed by these two suspected white supremacists. And I think that there is something going on with that case that is much deeper than or much, I guess, more involved than we are being led to know. And I think that that's something that we need to investigate. I think it's really tragic that we can see images that would suggest a Black child is suffering. I mean, that that image where the young boy was with the police officer, it was easily, I mean, it's easy to see that there's something clearly disturbed with that child. And we all saw it, And some of us made mention of it, but it was on the news, and nobody was bringing up how, how tragic that image looked, and how messed up it was that you have an image of a kid crying that hard, and there was no follow up. So I think we need to make pay very close attention to the suffering of Black children, especially those of Black children that are in direct custody of suspected white supremacists. And I think I'll just go ahead and mute my line from there. And lastly, I wanted to say, be mindful of people who are trying to justify the murder of Stephon Clark. I know that there's been questions about, or there's been tweets that he's made that are questionable and anti-Black associations that he's had. But if any of us were put under enough scrutiny, there would be plenty of mistakes and things that we have done that people could use to say that we were justified in getting murdered. And I've also been hearing a number of Black people parroting the white supremacist line that he was stealing cars. Please, whenever somebody is in this situation, don't try to look for a perfect victim or a perfect Black person to be a victim. We're all victims. We can all be victimized in the same way. Thank you so much.
Much obliged. Mr. Demery Ford, did you have commentary, sir? You should be with us.
Yes. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. I tuned in late, so I didn't hear the clips, but I listened to some of the comments, and I heard something about COINTELPRO and the war against Black people here in America. And then what came to mind is the aerial assault in Philadelphia. I guess it was the first and only aerial assault against American citizens in Philadelphia, where I think it was John Africa and his family was bombed. And it was one of the worst cases of the government's war against Black people and the government, with the backing of racism, white supremacy. And also, I wanted to comment on, I guess the young man's name was Stephon. The last caller just called his name, but I watched the video, and it was extremely upsetting. It was almost to the point that I was nauseous, and I almost threw up when the cops pretended to cover their tracks, saying that, you know, speaking to a corpse, you know, they had just killed a man, and talking about, are you all right, sir? You know, do you have anything on you? We can't approach you until you tell us we're all right. We can't. And they knew the man was dead. And then they turned him over, and now he only had a cell phone. It was just, I had to do everything I could to just watch the end of it. But one last thing is, I think when we are exercising counter-racism strategies, we should think about non-participation with Easter coming up. I hear a lot of people saying that there's no need in fighting because there's nothing can be done. We're in a hopeless situation. But I think that it's a lot that can be done, and starting with the people, one person at a time, you doing something. If it's only non-participation, you know, running up the cost to practice racism and other activities that don't really require a whole lot, just a presence of mind, and to help get the word out to warn other black people that we are in a state of war, regardless of what they perceive in their mind. And thanks for the shout out last night. My wife's doing fine now. We had, everything's on her. She had to run down a racist suspect that hit her in the rear, take down his license plate number. Then when she went to the police, they didn't want to do anything. He was a white guy. She had to swear out a warrant for him. We got him dragged into court, got a judgment against him. She's having surgery right now. And so on the 4th, she complete the other surgery and we'll be going to court sometime this summer. So hopefully we'll be able to run up the cost of practicing racism. I appreciate this show. I love you guys, and everybody take care. It's Mr. Demi for signing off. Thank you.
Thoughts, prayers to your wife. Hope the surgery goes fantastic this coming week, and run up a extraordinary bill for the race soldier to pay for, to compensate for all of the trouble and terrorism that he has targeted on you and your family and your wife specifically. And that right there, those traffic incidents, I know a number of non-white people who have had unfortunate traffic incidents with race soldiers where it was an individual classified as white who was at fault, and they tried to run off or what have you. In those moments, to the best of your ability, if you can at minimum get your phone so you can take a picture of the license plate, because I know non-white people where that's what happened. White person was at fault and they ran off really quick. If you can just the best that you can to stay calm and think first, get phone, license plate, picture in case they try to run off or, you know, just behave as racists do. We had two people that wrote in specifically about the segment about children, mistreatment of black children. The first person wrote in, us, a black female. I'm unable to call in, but I wanted to comment. I went to Duke University, North Carolina, out of high school and witnessed the mistreatment of black males on the basketball team firsthand. These young men were often, as was stated in the clip, mistreated in the classroom, but exalted on the court. They were shunted into majors like sociology, although many of them had varied interests and were trying to pursue majors like political science or the pre-med track. Duke was known for pre-med. They were not getting an education. In fact, they were discouraged from doing so. In fact, one young man on the team, after spending a week on a project for a course, was ridiculed by his instructor in front of the entire class. These young males are not student athletes. They are mercenaries without pay. Slaves, metaphor. I also, like the male caller, have a son who is around Tamir Rice's age when he was executed. The murder of my child is one of my greatest fears as well. Other person that wrote in, also a black female. Went out with my children. I noticed that white people consistently make the same comments about my children or my parenting, regardless of our behavior. They make comments such as, "He's tearing up the place." I usually ignore this comment, and if they laugh, I keep a serious, straight face. Next comment, "You have your hands full." To which I respond, "And so is my heart." Love that one. Next, "Sorry, I'm staring at your kids, but they are just so fill in the blank." To which I respond, "Yes, I noticed, and I find that to be impolite. Please stop." Black self-respect. I learned today that white people enjoy seeing black children misbehave in public. I have heard other non-white people who have come to the same conclusion. That's why I said I think they love the hate you give. Black misbehavior, every page. Other folks that we've missed completely, anybody else that dialed in with a hand up that we've not heard from at all, please do not wait until the last few minutes.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, to the Cal's audience. Hey, Gus, before I go any further, wanted to know if you covered the Texas woman that was sentenced for voting supposedly illegal.
No, sir.
Okay. First, I want to piggyback off what Ken Steele was talking about with that gentleman, David Hogg.
Yeah, I think for some reason I've caught him just by chance on several interviews, and he keeps yelling out inner city violence needs to be looked at as, though the way he's saying it, it's like he's trying to show sympathy for the community, for the inner city of the community, which I would like to, well, this is my opinion on how I interpret this. When I think about the climate change propaganda going on, I think David Hogg would be a great sales pitch person for that agenda. What I mean by that is that the climate change gentrification is really what's going on with that whole push about resilient cities. Myself and Thomas from New York, we've come to interpret the language as carbon emissions equaling too much Negro energy, and climate change meaning the tension that's being experienced by the white folks who have to live within close proximity. The danger of these resilient cities with the climate change, going into what David Hogg is talking about, is that the resilient city is built on the idea we have to push people from the shore areas, which is mostly wealthy folks, into the mainland. And in the mainland, when these wealthy folks come in more closer proximity to less financially fortunate people, they ultimately will use their dollars to clear the path so they can live amongst the inner city without walking outside and having to deal with too much carbon emission. That goes into what I would actually piggyback on to what the gentleman was talking about with teaching. He said we need to learn to understand what we're reading, and I wholeheartedly agree. So I'll say this to our audience, is that particularly when we're reading just standard old articles like NPR and all that, we're reading a sensational version of a story, somebody else's opinion. I would encourage people go straight to the journal of an article, because the person, the author who's actually theorizing this or philosophizing this is the person writing the journal. You get a chance to see how they think, how they write. And I want to end that this my commentary, if you don't mind, Gus, let me read this about the Texas woman. Is that okay, sir?
Let's hear it.
Okay. It says, Texas woman sentenced to 5 years for illegal voting. On November 8, 2016, Crystal Mason got out of work and drove through the rain to her home in Dallas. She walked through the door and tried to settle in for the evening, but her mother delivered something akin to a scolding. Quote, "You have to go vote," Mason's mother said, according to her attorney, J. Warren St. John, who spoke with NPR. Mason grabbed her keys and set out for her local precinct. When she got there, she found out that her name was not on the voter roll, so she was given a provisional ballot. An election worker stuck around to walk her through the form. She used her current license and her current address, St. John says. After she cast her vote, she went home. Quote, "She had a good faith belief that she could vote," St. John says. She would have never voted if she didn't know she couldn't vote. The next time she thought about that night, she was being arrested. She was detained by sheriffs in February 2017 at the Dallas County Courthouse while meeting with her probation officer. I'll leave it there. And I want to say this, Gus, before I get off the phone, is that the gentleman who was talking about the religious stuff kind of made me think about that part where the mother had pressured her into believing that if you don't go vote, you're doing you're committing a carnal sin. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Other folks, anybody that we missed completely, dial in with a hand up that we've not heard from. Anybody that we have? Oh, yes, sir. If you could speak up.
Oh, yes. Can I be heard now, Gus?
Go
ahead, sir.
Oh, okay. Our caller in Florida yielded the floor.
I apologize. Thank you. Gus, I just had a quick question. So in the context of white supremacy, what does it mean to be white? What does it mean to be classified as white? And if you're classified as a white person, what does that mean to non-white people?
In my opinion, to be classified as white, if you're asking it that way, to be classified as white, what does that mean to non-white people? In my view, that means enemy. Someone who is classified as white, this is someone who is a member of a race that is dedicated to terrorizing, subjugating, and abusing everyone in the known universe that they classify as white. But again, that's why I ask on the program, where I recommend that non-white people think about that exact question. What does it mean to be classified as white, and come to a conclusion about that? Then you can go about, you know, assembling your counter-racist code in terms of how you're going to relate to and deal with these individuals. But that's what it means to me. If you want to make it a one word answer, one of the few times, if I can give you one, since you're asking me personally what it means, enemy. Does that answer your question?
Yes, sir.
Anyone else that we missed? Caller in Florida, down at the courthouse. Did you have commentary?
Oh, yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to also start out with David Hall. I'm noticing that, the way that he's, the speech and the delivery of this person, it does make me feel suspicious. I'm not trying to get into any comparable metaphors. It just seems like when I hear him speak, I do sense like it's an agenda or some kind of a plan behind it. And I'm noticing also that I don't know if Dr. King was kind of linked to this March for Our Lives directly or indirectly, but I think I remember hearing it somewhere that one of his quotes were mentioned or something. Maybe it was on social media, but I'm in agreement with the previous callers who mentioned that they're trying to decrease gun ownership among Black people. I think that's how it was worded. When it comes to the I think it was a clip of the Stephon Clark's brother who was, it looks like he was in a meeting of some sort, like around the local white politicians in his area. And I think the media, they try to portray a certain type of reputation on the emotion of Black people, and they try to portray that, hey, you know, we have a lot of, suppressed emotional issues, things like that. But what I'm noticing, comparatively, the white people, that was behind the desk, they were very calm, okay? It didn't seem like they were getting upset or annoyed or agitated, at least not to me. And I think we should take note of that, because that looked like that was a very, I guess you can say, intense environment. So if we could just really take notes or just observe and analyze that kind of behavior, I think it'll really help us out, not just in the context of this situation, because these kinds of shootings, unfortunately, are happening or occurring on a consistent basis. Contempt for Black males, Black life in general, of course. And with the student athlete, I think it's been reported that I believe the football teams generate the most revenue, I believe, for these campuses, and they get out here to program young children at a very young age. And I've even noticed some of the young Black males here locally, they're only thinking that, hey, you know, I can't make it out, or I can't achieve another type of talent or profession. Or I think it was a rap lyric, it's only, I only can rap or play ball or something like that. I'm not sure who rapped it, but just that programming, that intense programming, that we can't achieve anything else but what we are taught we can only achieve. And, that's the only thing I have right now, and thanks for allowing me to share.
I think the lyric is either you have to slang rock or have a wicked jump shot. Yes. Might have. Yes. Not that I'm proud to be able to remember that, but yes, I think that's it. Anywho, any folks that we have missed completely, anybody that has a hand up that we've not heard from at all? We got everybody? Nobody that we missed completely who has a hand up? Spectacular, spectacular. Anybody have? Oh, I had additional commentary. The first one, I appreciate Red in Nevada for the news report, the caller that dialed in, Crystal Mason, the black female who was victimized, incarcerated for voting, no less. Checking the news, being informed, Dr. Welsing, certainly something that she encouraged, Dick Gregory as well, Grandcestors. The report about Stephon Clark, and I've said, you know, for a long time, I do not keep up with the police shootings. That is going to happen as long as the system of white supremacy exists. I've not watched the video. I don't watch any of those videos. However, I do try to at least read so I'm informed about what happened, right? That segment on NPR, where they were getting information about the autopsy report that the family got, Stephon Clark's family got an independent autopsy report that he was shot in the back all these times, 20 times, as they said. Dr. Welsing would comment about that again, white genetic annihilation. But I thought it was important, all of the disruption that they had in the audio segment. This was NPR, right? I mean, they got a lot of money. This is not some raggedy operation where they're struggling to get a budget and to have people, you know, invest in NPR. All of that disruption in the phone call, and they ultimately lost the guest completely. That is a rare occurrence. I listen to NPR on a daily basis, weekends included, and I mean, that does not happen. They talk to people all over the world, on Skype, phone line, in the studio. It is very rare that you hear them just lose somebody completely, where the person is talking and they're just gone. Like, oh man, I guess we lost them. Don't know what happened. We'll try to get them later for that subject matter. And particularly, they were talking about Bennett Omalu. That, to me, huge alert went up, because Bennett Omalu, in addition to what they said in the segment about concussion and the movie and Will Smith and the NFL and brain damage and all of that, CTE, yes, that's accurate. More recently, Bennett Omalu was just in the news saying that the whites, the enforcement officers, that they were tampering with autopsy reports and changing reports, particularly as it related to police-involved shootings like Stephon Clark. So for him to come out and make this report, I was thinking, wow, did this have to go through the same facility that he just said the race soldiers there were tampering with reports and making his job? I think, in fact, I just played it. He said that they were dismembering bodies of deceased victims in the morgue. I mean, he was making huge allegations. I think even a white person had quit from this facility saying that, yeah, they were doing, she was corroborating the allegations that he was making. But I remember that just because I do try to check the news. I haven't been as great with the flood disruption, but I'm trying to get back on my counter-racist grind that just happened. And I thought of that as well, because they could have added that to give further context to what's happening with Stephon Clark. I'll post that report again, but he just said that. It might have been this month. It was this year, certainly, about his concerns about what was happening in the police station, or with the morgue and the forensic department specifically. Any other folks comment that they wanted to get in before we wrap things up? Any final quick thoughts? Let's see. Red in Nevada, was that you?
Yes, and I'll make it quick. Another thing I did want to say was that I think about the cows a lot and all the different suggestions I get. And I was actually thinking about Ivy, especially when I go to work, because I missed this most recent workplace racism show. But what had happened this past week, the same racist
I don't actually try to speak to her, and I actually have been able to avoid her during lunch. But, of course, they'll come to your desk. And most recently, came to my desk, decided to say something to me, like greet me or something like that, still called me the wrong name. I still corrected her. She was like, she kind of laughed to herself. She was like, I don't know why I keep doing that. Well, you know, it's okay. And laughed and kind of went and, you know, chuckled a little bit more and like went off. And I was thinking, because it's like, I know it's not the right frame of mind to think, but sometimes I really try not to be the angry black female. And I felt like I was going to go off on her, but I just tried to like laugh to myself, like this is what she's going to do. But I really just felt like, you know, saying it's not okay. And I wasn't, of course, going to get really loud or anything. But, I mean, I just try to make sure I just stay codified. And that's all I wanted to add. Thank you.
Workplace Racism's Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The male caller who spoke up simultaneously, did you have a quick comment?
Yeah. I just wanted to say real quick, if you guys remember the case about the Felicia Jackson, the black caseworker that was kicked off the plane for escorting a little white girl back to her custodial parent, which was the father back in New York. And I just brought that. I just wanted to bring that up to let you know how people view black people with a white child versus white people with a black child. As regards to the heart situation with the lesbian white supremacist couple. And that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
9 years of the cows. If you go all the way back to October 2009, we had a black male guest on the program. His mother-in-law adopted a white child, and he had a lot of interesting anecdotes about being stopped, terrorized, questioned, looked at with spite for having a young white girl, I think she was 6 at the time, with him. Any other folks that we missed completely? Mark Riding, that's his name, Mark Riding. Any other folks that we missed? Thomas in New York.
Yes, sir. I just wanted to say, Mr. Demery, first I wanted to ask the firefighter, I wanted to know if his school that he works at has metal detectors, and I know he's in the Florida area. So Mr. Demery, May 31st, 1921, Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Negro Wall Street District of Greenwood neighborhood is bombed from the air. I think that would be the first time that they used aerial force against us. And they actually have video footage of this with in the little Red Baron planes. It's like, it's not funny, but to see those type of planes and they bombed that district. All because a black man bumped into a Sioux Africa. And I mute my mom.
The Sioux Africa reference for the program. I actually had a note of Sioux Africa written down today as well. Retired firefighter, metal detectors at your institution, yay or nay?
What's that?
Do they have metal detectors at the school where you volunteer or do your coaching? Do they have metal detectors? Yes or no?
No, sir. I don't think they have any metal detectors at any Miami-Dade County public schools. My offspring just said, except for alternative schools, They do have them.
Okay. Assist from the offspring, right on. Any other folks, quick comment they need to get in before we wrap? You can do it in 30 seconds or less. Yes, ma'am.
Just quickly, Mr. Demery, I hope everything goes well. I've been praying for you and your family. Hope you get the compensation you deserve. I wanted to say that I do think it's great for people to, you know, care about black people and women and animals and all of that. And also, you know, Mr. Renegade, wanted to let you know there's just the things that you do to honor women and just even being more patient with us, letting us talk longer than probably we should, more than you allow males to do that. I think you even allowed that earlier with me, and I thank you so much for that. And I'll always be, you know, forever grateful for how you honor women, for being a personal recipient of that. And the last thing that I wanted to say is that the idea of the notion of black male privilege is further verbal abuse against black males, because imagine if there was this notion of women privilege or children privilege, the outrage that would happen. It's outrageous to say black male privilege, given that they are the most victimized group on the planet. And I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus, and thanks everyone else for listening.
Indeed. The caller at 4683, did you have a comment you needed to get in? 4683?
No, hey, girl, don't just say hey here about it, man. I'm on the plantation. I can't talk about it. I try to listen. Thank you, though.
Oh, greetings. Stay safe. If you are working, be alert. Stay safe. I'm sure there are race soldiers that are around who are paying a lot of attention to you. Workplace racism, again, Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We will wrap things there. I think we got everybody. I don't see any hands that I missed. I'm trying to make sure I didn't miss a caller with a hand up. Yes, I think we got everybody for our program. We'll be here on Tuesday. Again, we'll be discussing racism, white supremacy, yoga, black females. We've made a whole yoga retreat for health and replenishing for black people, black females specifically. And talking about some of the reasons why they made this retreat and even some of the experiences that they had prior to that and doing yoga in the same space with race soldiers. But that should be this coming Tuesday. Just check the schedule. There might be a program prior to that. Just, you know, check Black Talk Radio Network, the Facebook page for the updates. But we'll definitely be here on Tuesday evening. Thanks to everyone who participated, listened in, wrote, called. Hope it was constructive investment of your Saturday evening. I will again suggest, I know the weather is getting nice. It was super warm in Seattle today. If you want to go out and frolic, great. You still want to be codified when you're out and about. Race soldiers, they do not pause from terrorizing just because the sun is shining a little brighter. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. When you're out having a good time, you still want to be able to think clearly and make phenomenal decisions to keep yourself safe. We are still in a system of white supremacy, and you still might have to deal with a race soldier. Just keep that in mind. I know Dr. Welsing would certainly encourage strongly endorse us being sober so that we can protect our health and brain computers so that we can make great decisions and create new concepts to help us permanently solve the problem. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. Certainly, if you're going to be out and about in a vehicle, buckle up every time, in addition to being sober, whether you're a driver or passenger. Anything that we can do to minimize contact with race soldiers, let's do it. Buckling the seatbelt, that's an easy one. Staying off the phone in the vehicle, that's another easy one. Minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.